I call the regular meeting of the Savannah County Board of Supervisors to order. We'll begin with the Pledge of Allegiance, followed by the moment of silence.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. We have the adoption of the agenda.
Mr. Chair.
Had my keys around there, don't laugh.
Mr. Chair, I've got a...
Yes, I imagine that. Mr. Dahl's got a change.
I have a few items that kind of just popped up here, short notice here. One, under unfinished business, I would just like to have a quick discussion with the board about the burn building. And then under new business, I received a request from Blue Ridge Health District about funding carryover request, and that should be a fairly short conversation. And then one is about a jaunt, a proxy member for voting for officers for jaunt or an executive director. So they're looking for some direction. So I just would like to add those three items.
You had one more to add, didn't you, on new business?
Oh, well, yeah. If about reading public comments, you know, right now it's really to have a discussion on public comments and the way that we allow public comments come through.
Alrighty. And what was that? The first two again.
So one was under unfinished.
I got burn building.
Yeah, burn building. Under new business, Blue Ridge Health District carryover request. Jaunt proxy.
All right, hang on. And John Proxy.
Proxy. And then the last one is public comments.
All righty. Hey. Yeah. All righty. So do we have a motion for the adoption of the agenda with the changes made?
So made.
Do I have a second? Got a motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Mrs. Booker. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
The acoustics are definitely better than they are in the other building. I'm sorry.
I hear you.
I was like, oh my gosh, I talk really quiet.
Please don't.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. As long as you make sure you can, that we're registering with you.
You are good.
Okay. Next up is the County Administrator's Report.
Yep. Mr. Chair, members of the board, just a few things to report this evening. So one, a happy belated birthday to Mrs. Eager. We forgot it at the last board meeting, but September 9th, she had a birthday. And so, like I said, happy belated birthday to Mrs. Eager. Yep.
16.
We also have some new employees to announce. Diamante Anderson, Family Services Specialist for Social Services. She started September 13th. Jordan Allen, a deputy in training for the Sheriff's Office. He started September 13th. And then we also had Julie Dane, Administrative Assistant for the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office. She started on September 13th as well. A little announcement. So the Government Finance Officers Association, BGFOA, has awarded the Certificate of Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting to Fluvanna County again for its comprehensive annual financial report for the fiscal year ended June 30th, 2020. Again, you know, this has been judged on by a panel, and it seeks to look for high standards of the program, and, you know, looks for comprehensive annual financial reports that that are demonstrating spirit of full disclosure, making it easy to read, showing the financial story of the county. So again, I just want to recognize and congratulate the finance department for a job well done again on that.
How many do they give out that? Do you have any idea?
I don't know how many they give out on that. I know.
The state? The whole state?
No, this is U.S. U.S. and Canada. I mean, so you have to submit for it. So I don't know what the number of organizations that get that, but I think this is probably number 10, 11, 12, 13 in a row. Yeah. So
doing something right.
Yeah. So again, congratulations to them. Also, congratulations to Ms. Harris for being accepted into the ICMA Equity Officer Institute. So the program identifies individuals serving as chief equity officers or having some adjunct responsibilities kind of on the county half. So this program, it helps to build a learning community for ICMA members for equity, inclusion, and social justice. So for the program, there were 33 individuals accepted in the program throughout the U.S. Six of those, out of that 33, there are six of them from Virginia. Out of the six, there are four from Central Virginia. Ms. Harris was one of them. So, like I said, I think it's a good thing for us to have some representation in that.
Is that done through what university?
It's through the International City County Management Association, okay. ICMA.
Okay. Congratulations. Good.
Yep.
There's actually two. The other is through the Virginia Local Government Managers Association, which is through UVA, Institute of Government.
I thought UVA would probably.
Yeah. Yeah. This coming Monday, September 20th, 2021, at the Pleasant Grove Park down at the Pole Barn, we're going to have an employee health and wellness fair. That'll be from 11:30 to 1:30. Lunch will be provided. There'll be raffles, giveaways. They're also going to be doing health screenings and flu shots. So if you want to get a flu shot, Miss Snow, can they get them right on the spot, or would someone have to register ahead of time?
They have been registered ahead of time. There's a waiver that they'll have, but we'll have someone sign.
Yep.
She knows someday. So,
yep. So if anyone is interested, there is an opportunity to get a flu shot at the Health and Wellness Fair this coming Monday. And a little butterfly garden rededication. So the butterfly garden out at Pleasant Grove Park. The butterfly garden's been there for how many years, Mr. Spitzer?
2014.
So six, seven, eight years. So through the generous donations from the Rosnagel family, they donated a lot of materials for this. Really, the butterfly garden's there, but to make it and keep some of the critters, namely Bambi, out of there, they wanted to put up some fencing and protect it. So you see they made a nice gate, and they put a lot of taller fencing around it to protect the butterfly garden, fencing materials. And then there's also a special remembrance for garden companion Randy Beck. And then there's some new interns that passed the classroom portion of the Master Gardeners training program. The butterfly garden members, they want to invite anyone from the community for a rededication ceremony that they're going to be doing this Saturday, September 18th at 10 a.m. out there. And that is it. And then also, some upcoming board meetings. October 6th, we have a 4 p.m. regular meeting here in the Performing Arts Center. October 20th, we have a 7 p.m. regular meeting at the Performing Arts Center. And November 3rd, we have a 4 p.m. regular meeting. And we're going to say here at the Performing Arts Center. And the reason I'll say that is, and I'm just going to chime on this, is we had a full house last night for the Planning Commission meeting out here for the Village Gardens rezoning. The Planning Commission and the applicant requested a deferral for that, and so the deferral will probably be pushed out till the November meeting, and that's, I think, November 9th. So instead of trying to have, Planning Commission meeting somewhere else, we think we're just going to continue to have it here for a little while longer. It's got great space to accommodate the residents and the crowds that we had. We had about 50 people here in person last night. I think there's about 30 to 40 people online as well. So again, just some meetings coming up, but I'm happy to answer any questions from the board.
Any questions? Thank you so much, sir. Now I'll open the first round of public comment. Anyone wishing to address the board, please step to the mic. State your name, address, keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and directed to the board. Also, please remember, if you are here to speak to one of the public hearings, please wait until that public hearing comes up. Is there anyone wishing to speak for public comment at this time?
I'm Susie Morris. I live at 6840 Thomas Jefferson Parkway, Palmyra, at Quinkley Farm. Property rights. What is the proper consideration for the property rights of those who own the surrounding and adjoining property in A1 when an individual owner or owners and developers wish to rezone? It would appear that those adjoining owners should have at least equal rights. And why do Fluvanna citizens who want to do businesses in an area at their homes, no real complaints prior, have to, for a church and several homes, be mandated a specific type of fence, facing specific directions, etc., etc., when developers can say, oh, we don't do fences as buffers, when there are gated communities, when there are also senior communities, when there are threes, and when they're in A1s, farms, ag and forestal districts, and rural preservation. But they offer a three-board fence to appease those at Tufton Lake. Three boards don't keep anything out, not animals, not kids. Why are individual landowners ignored? Developers appear only to want to appease those areas where you have a greater population. Where you have an individual home or family, that doesn't matter as much. Please look at the comp plan 2015 on page 65 at some point. When development occurs in a rural preservation area, appropriate buffering should be required. That buffering should be as requested by the adjoining A1 or R1 owners, as done in the case of individual Fluvanna citizens who have to meet requirements to do things in next to adjoining properties. Why do landowners who often don't live here and big money developers who don't seem to care much about Fluvanna County or ruining citizens' quality of life seemingly have greater rights than long-time and current property owners? All of this rezoning is defined in the 2015 comp plan on page 28. On that page, it is called spot zoning. Please refer to that at some point. Please refresh your memory on reading that. This appears to be the only way we can continue one residential development after another, etc., etc. If this continues, the people who have invested in their homes, farms, and businesses who live here are doomed. The constant spot rezoning is the only way we're being devoured by developers and developments. People here should have equal or possibly greater rights, property rights, than those who come here to make money or who sell Fluvanna out at our expense and destruction of current citizens' quality of life and investments in forever homes. Another comment, solar panels. The world talks clean, green energy, but who has checked or researched the toxic materials in solar panels? Who has checked to see where the decommissioning or disposal takes place? By which companies? There appear to be few. Solar panels cannot go in landfills. They cannot be stored for more than 90 days. There are fines levied. There have been problems with the parent companies selling and selling to another company and another company. When this occurs numerous times, sometimes it's hard for the individual towns, counties, cities, or individuals to catch up with who actually owns these now. Then the town or county or individual is the one responsible, or the farmer, if they put it on their land for decommissioning fees. In 20 or 30 years, the panels depreciate and eventually will cost quite a bit to decommission. Could be hundreds of thousands of dollars. It could be in the millions. Weather can change panels. If left damaged, panels can leak hazardous waste into soil and water. Do you have the names of decommissioning entities? I researched this topic for several months a year or two ago when we were approached. And I made the decision after that research not to put any solar farm on another piece of land, which was not on Point Lee. Please read the handout and please check the 2015 comp plan. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, ma'am. Anyone else wishing to speak in public comment? Ms. Harris, do you see anybody online?
There is no one.
Okay, seeing no one else, I'll now close first round of public comment. Okay, next up is public hearing for A, SUP 2104, Joseph Carl Bradley, commercial kennel. Mr. Miles.
Yes, good evening, Chairman Sheridan, members of the board. We have before you tonight SUP 2104 commercial kennel request. This is the request of Joseph Carl Bradley. A special use permit request within the A1 Agricultural General District to permit a commercial kennel with respect to 5 acres of Tax Map 23, Section A, Parcel 30, and located at 5464 Venable Road. The subject parcel is located within the Rural Preservation Planning Area and in the Columbia Election District. I think most of you are probably familiar with that. It's in the Venable Road Kent Store area in the northeast portion of the county. I want to go through two definitions because these came up at the Planning Commission on August 10th when we discussed this case. So the commercial kennel request is a place that's designed for commercial kennel and training for dogs, and that's for compensation. Private kennel request or operation, really, through the treasurer's office is when someone is really just doing this more as a hobby, raising things that that are more related to themselves and their family, and the key part is for which commercial gain is not the primary objective. So there is a difference, and that's why one is named commercial and other private. So this is the location of the 5 acre parcel on Venable Road. And there is a very large farm located, tract of land behind Mr. Bradley's property. The opposite side of the road is Bird Chapel Cemetery and Church, and then there's various other agricultural homes and farms in the area. So we began working with Mr. Bradley, I believe, in March or April, right before Easter, with him relative to the use of the property, and indirectly what I think brought him in the office was his commercial kennel building plans. So what we had him do, myself and the building official Andy Wills, we met with him and he provided the proposed building and plans. What you see here is kind of the final iteration of the building plans. It went to the Planning Commission on June 8th. And at that time, there was considerable concerns and opposition. And then as part of the conditions, we'll explain later, but just while we're on the slide, the concern was with outdoor runs. And you'll see in the top right-hand corner where he's initialed the most recent set of plans on the portion where the outdoor runs, and actually what you see in the larger picture in the center left is where the outdoor runs are. The one in the lower right portion, which is the, I believe, the north side of the building, then that would be where outdoor runs would not be permitted. So it was an attempt by the applicant and also the community to make it clear that there'd be only 10 outdoor runs and not 20. The building couldn't be later upgraded to additional commercial outdoor runs. And kind of this is what I was talking about earlier. We first held the actual public hearing on June 8th at the Planning Commission meeting. And there were several residents that did write in and provide expressed written concerns and information to us. And then because of that, and Mr. Bradley attempting to address some of their concerns, some were known to them, some were unknown to them. So the next best option, Mr. Zimmer of the Columbia District asked if Mr. Bradley would take a 60-day deferral, which he did, and asked staff, myself, and Jason Overstreet, senior planner, to set up a conference call because we were still pretty, we weren't sure we were coming out of Governor Northam's mandate and so forth around the July 1st time frame. So we set up a conference call, conducted that with Mr. Bradley and several of Mr. Bradley's neighbors, myself, Mr. Overstreet, and Mr. Zimmer, and Mr. Mel Sheridan. So along those lines, the meeting was very productive. Mr. Bradley had put into some measures and some information himself on the property. I think basically invisible fence, other barking collar type things. He was trying to do everything that he could with his own dogs and then client dogs that he would eventually have on the property. Then after this community meeting concluded, Mr. Overstreet and then directly myself worked with Mr. Bradley to bring forward the request back to the Planning Commission on August 10th. And generally, I think things had been worked out, and I'm going to say most concerns were addressed because there were some things that folks were still a little bit concerned about, but at the same time, I think Mr. Bradley attempted and has done a good job up to this point to address those. So what I'd like to do before Mr. Bradley comes up is kind of go over, a lot of these are regular special use permit conditions towards the end, but up front, the conditions are built more for this commercial kennel request and specifically on this property. So it's your standard condition that it only goes to Mr. Bradley. It cannot, if he sells the property, it does not run with the land on this property. It's condition two is getting more into the building that we showed you earlier on the premises, and that it normally is set like 15 and 25 feet from property lines for an accessory ag, kind of accessory detached garage, so to speak. But he we've worked with him to have that set further away, spacing it at least 50 feet from property lines on a 5-acre parcel. That's not hard to do. So, and then with the working with him, he suggested and the solid board fencing and vinyl fencing, either one if he wants to go that route for the maintenance, and screening the outdoor runs from the adjacent property owners. Condition three is another one that we worked with Mr. Wills and Mr. Bradley and I all worked together at one point this spring before he filed, and then presented some of this to him as he filed. Noise attenuation. He can choose to do insulation of the building himself, not only for energy purposes, but for sound, if that works out. And the plans that he's going to submit to for this building would be have those other details and elements shown. And generally, it's we're just indicating that both from the building code side and myself for setbacks. We normally do that for any garage, but this is just more for a commercial aspect of it. So this is kind of the heart of it. This is where we worked with the community to negotiate some of the information relative to, there was a lot of questions originally is, which dogs on your property are personal, which dogs would be client dogs, It's hard for us to know, and on the flip side, it's hard for myself or Scott Miller, the code enforcement officer, or anyone to really know. So to be fair and direct in working with both Mr. Bradley as the business owner and property owner, to have kind of make that clear and on both sides, so he can operate successfully and we hopefully don't have any concerns from him, so, from his property. So basically, it did put a cap on 10 dogs, 10 client dogs, 10 outdoor runs, only on the south side, like we mentioned earlier, and the plans would not change. You can't come in and file a building permit and say, well, you know, I've changed a different plan, so we've had him authorize and sign and date those. The outdoor training time frames, pretty wide open, Monday through Saturday, dawn to dusk. We don't want to try to figure out if it's 7 a.m., you know, in the winter and, you know, 9 p.m. in the summer. So, but we did have concerns on Sundays, and I think that it's normally practiced in working with you all at the Planning Commission and Board that Sundays, especially with a church nearby, is typically 1 to 6. And also 1 to 6 for just people when they return from church or, you know, preparing for church to go elsewhere in the community in Kent Store or Palmyra. And also to give Mr. Bradley and his family a break, too. He's a hard-working business owner, needs to have Sunday mornings. So overall, the outdoor training would not have personal or client dogs having concerns with that. And relative to the Virginia Department of Health requirements, that's taken care of if there is a complaint to police, the sheriff, and animal control. So a lot of these are your final three conditions that really remain unchanged that you see on most of our special use permits. So we did try to keep a lot of the uniform things where we were working with them on the front to middle end of the conditions. The key part, or key thing to let you know, Mr. Overstreet did work with throughout the summer with the Sheriff's Department and the Animal Control Office, and the calls for service relative to concerns were not shown. Major Wells did look for us for other calls or concerns. There were things that basically I would say were unreported, but things that were looked into as opposed to official filing of a complaint. So really at this point, I would be able to answer any questions. And also, I believe Mr. Bradley wants to come up. He has indicated, to come up and accept the gate conditions as presented. He's interested in accepting the gate conditions. And if you all have questions of myself first, or if you'd like to hear from Mr. Bradley.
Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Miles? No? Okay, Mr. Bradley.
Good evening. My name is Justin Bradley. My address is 546 Venable Road, Kent Store, Virginia. And I'm here to accept the conditions and answer any questions anyone may have.
Do you all have any questions?
I think you've done a remarkable job to satisfy the concerns that the community has had. And many people have 10 to 20 dogs, 100 people who train dogs to hunt. So thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
All right, hearing none. Thank you.
Good luck.
All right, hearing no questions, we'll open the public hearing. Please keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Is there anyone who should speak at this time? Ms. Harris, do you have any on? No one inside? Okay, seeing none. With no one else wish to speak, we will close the public hearing. Any questions or comments from the board?
The training that he's doing, is it what kind of training? Obedience training?
No, ma'am. I believe it's hunting. Is it hunting? Mr. Bradley, step up, please.
I do gun dog training for retrievers, so duck hunting, waterfowl hunting. We do AKC hunt tests where we go to grounds around the state and sometimes out of state to run hunt tests. This proves trainability of the dogs and shows they are intelligent enough to be trained. And that's what I do. And I'm an avid waterfowler, duck hunter, goose hunter. So I've been doing this since I got out of the military in 2006. And once COVID hit, I had to make a choice, either I do this or to make a living, because I couldn't drive Uber anymore, which I did after graduating college. So, and here I am now.
So you were somewhere else training?
Day to day, I often train on other properties around Fernando County where I have permission. Mr. Hucks, I train on his property. Mr. Nystrom, who lives on Collins Road, is a 150-acre farm. I train on his because he has multiple ponds. I train in Goochland. The guy's name is Yankee. I don't know his real name. He's a great guy. I also train right beside, I don't know if you know, I'm sure you do, the veterinarian off of Rodin Lake Road. His neighbor, I train on those ponds quite a bit. So day to day, I'm not always in my yard. However, if a young dog comes, I do start with obedience. Everything I do is based on obedience. I send the dog to retrieve, they bring it back to me, they sit. That's their job. So even we do what we call blind retrieves, where I send the dog out, I blow a whistle, and I tell them which way to go. This is what I demonstrated for Mr. Overstreet to show that I do have control of my dogs, whether on leash or off leash, with the use of electronic collars. But I will do obedience training in my yard. But that's just the beginning of it. Typically, one of the concerns was traffic, and typically a dog that's with me for gun dog training is at a minimum of 4 months. And it's a lot of people that call that want to bring a dog are from Maryland, North Carolina. They don't come until their dog's done. So there is no real traffic other than me coming in out of my driveway, you see me, and going to the other properties. But I do start in the yard with obedience, basic obedience, sit, hear, heel, place, things of that nature. And but the entire game of what we do is obedience training. It's not like your typical gun dog or deer dog where you let it loose and it barks to find game. This dog is supposed to sit still in a duck blind, not move. We harvest our game. When I tell you to move, you go get this duck and you come back. And that's what we do. And it's a good time to try.
And I'm gonna ask you a question. We talked last night.
Yes, sir.
I was under the false precept that the orange stakes in your front yard were where you were putting the building.
Yes,
but those are used as part of your training, I believe.
Yes, sir. So the blind, we call them blind stakes. So if I put bumpers at distances on some farms, 400 yards, and I will make that dog run 400 yards. If they get offline, I blow the whistle and give them directions to that pole. That pole allows me to see, so I don't forget where I put the bumper. Because the dog, you can't allow them to use their nose and hunt. You need control all the way to the bird. So those markers in my yard are for building up to that.
Right. I'm sorry.
That was a mistake that I made when you corrected me last night. I thought that quite frequently when somebody has orange stakes out, that marks the corners of where they're putting a building.
Yes,
that's
sir.
That's what
yes,
you and I talked about last night. The building's actually going back near the bird cage, correct?
Yes. So did you get a chance to at where my...
What he's referring to is it's going back. If you saw the house, it's going to be the picture of the house. It will be to the right of that and actually slightly further south.
Yes.
So how many dogs do you have personally on the...
Personally right now,
mm-hmm.
I have 5 retrievers
mm-hmm.
That are mine. One's retired. And all my dogs are currently, I do have a shed, and that's where they say it's heated, cooled. My plan and what I'm hoping to be able to do is maintain 6 to 8 dogs and use the other kennels for my own dogs, so they're not in my house. They're well cared for, they're all health tested, up to date on shots, everything. but I would like to be able to put them outside in a heated and cooled kennel rather than in my home. Because this is a hobby. I've been duck hunting since 2006, and I plan to continue to do that. And eventually, hopefully in the future, you know, I hope to have my own pedigree of dogs. And I don't plan to grow large because I don't plan on hiring anyone to help me. And as a single trainer, I can only train, especially when it's hot, so many dogs in a limited amount of time. So I don't plan, even before we put the stipulations, I did not plan on any more than ever 10 dogs.
Would that include, if you have a litter of puppies, you and I were talking about this last night, would that include 10 beyond your litter of puppies, or just your litter of puppies and then bring them in as you get those going?
So it would be in this building. We'll never have more than 10 dogs in this building. If I had a litter of puppies, they are raised in my home.
You do them downstairs?
No, I do them in my dining room. I am very...
My garage.
I love my dogs. They are well taken care of. I would not put them outside in the heat and leave them in the heat. I actually installed cameras so that I can see my dogs if I have to leave while I'm training. I can watch to make sure they go inside the AC. Because if they sit out there when it's 93 degrees, these dogs they have double coats. You're aware of this. The heat, they cannot take that. They're not like a hound that lives outside year-round their whole life. Our Labradors are not only used as tools to hunt, but they are companions. And they are not only used to hunt, they can be trained for anything. And that's the purpose of the AKC hunt test I run, to prove trainability. I have bred in the past. I have two puppies in California.
Wasn't saying it that way.
Well, I'm just telling you, I have two puppies in California who they use my dogs because they bring trained Malinois for police work. Mm-hmm. And so the Malinois cannot be trusted to not bite people. So they can't demonstrate with them outside of their genre. So they got dogs from me who are high drive, very trainable, very temperamental. They're very nice. So that they can go and do demonstrations with a Labrador Retriever instead of a Malinois.
Yeah.
Did I answer your question?
Yes.
Can I ask you one?
Have you had anyone to be concerned about the barking? I just read, because that was a concern from the church people, of the dogs who be barking during service or whatever.
So prior to this sign, I'm going to be 100% honest here. Prior to this sign being in my yard, I've never had one complaint about barking. Animal control, Mr. Miles said someone reported something unofficially. I'm still not aware of who or what that is about. No one has brought it to my attention until that sign went up. Now, I've had many concerns that I can't address them if I'm not aware of them. And I will do anything I can to appeal to my neighbors. That's why we are willing to do insulation. The dog doors we're planning to put is where I can close them at night. They can't go out at night. But along with some of these concerns, there was some confusion because there are packs of hounds around the properties of the farm that surrounds my house. And I've had complaints from people 2 miles down the road of my dogs barking, but there's a hound kennel across the street. I don't know how we can differentiate between which dogs are which. Because I have one neighbor that's very close, right across the street, and we explained to them we were going to insulate, we were going to put them inside. When Mel shared it with the community meeting, I explained to them if there's a funeral, because the biggest concern was we can't plan a funeral, so we can't put it in a regulation to where we can have you forced to put the dogs up. I told him, Mr. Sheridan, I lived here 10 years. I know when a funeral's coming because first the tractor comes to prepare the site. Then the blue tent goes up either the night before or the morning of. I will put the dogs up on my own. I'm not looking.
We need to get Paul to let you know when it is.
Yeah, I would love that. And if I don't know why we've never communicated in the past. I've kind of just always done, we all stick to ourselves. And at first when all this happened and the overwhelming concerns after we had spoke to people, I didn't know what to think. I was kind of like in awe, like, where is this coming from? And so now we've addressed every concern other than location, which I cannot change. change location. And I do, that's about as much as I can do at this point, so.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, there was someone who wished to speak, but wasn't unmuted at the time. Would you allow this person?
Yes, we'll allow them to speak.
I don't have a name, I'm sorry. There we go. They're unmuted.
Do we have a number?
It's the iPad, it looks like.
Just says iPad guest.
Okay. If you would like to speak for the public comment, a public hearing, please go ahead, state your name and address.
Patty Rayner, Broken Island.
Yes, ma'am.
So I wanted to just echo what Mrs. Morris had to say.
Oh, Ms. Rayner, are you talking about this specific public hearing that we're in right now, or do you want public comment, ma'am?
Comment.
Okay.
Ms.
Rayner, I will ask you, I hate to do this, we're in the middle of a public hearing, if you would wait for the second round of public comment, ma'am. I apologize that we didn't get you the first time, but we absolutely want to hear what you have to say. But this doesn't have to do with what we're doing right now, ma'am. Thank you. I apologize again, but we will get you back the second round of public comment. Okay. Hearing no others, do we have a motion?
I'll make a motion. I move that the Board of Supervisors approve Special Use Permit 2104, a request to permit a commercial kennel with respect to 5 ± acres of Tax Map 23, Section 8, Partial 30, subject to the 8 conditions as recommended by the Planning Commission and the Fluvanna County staff.
Second.
Yeah, motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Mrs. Seeger. All in favor say aye.
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 I wish you luck, and I'll do what I can to help you, but the chair's going to vote nay on this one. The closest tombstone to the house. Anyway, all right, motion passes 4-1. Mr. O'Brien, I'm going to ask you if you'll take over for a second. I'm going to step away and take a break.
Okay, next we have ZTA 2102, Solar Generation Facilities, Douglas Mile, Community Development Director.
Okay, Vice Chair O'Brien and members of the board. Yes, this is a countywide zoning text amendment for solar generation facilities. What we're looking at with you tonight is kind of a staged approach. We worked with the Planning Commission in a work session back in April and May, and this was coming out of the 2021 General Assembly changes, and in 2020 there were several proactive and positive changes for solar, especially for, which we'll get into in a minute here, for localities where in the past 5 or 6 years when we've been working on solar projects with developers and site agents, there haven't been things that we felt were beneficial to communities and localities, and that's now changing. So, do you want to read all the things with just the A's, A and R?
That's a lot there.
Yeah, so this is an ordinance amendment, and it's mainly for Fluvanna County Code for definitions, which we'll go over. Definitions and then uses permitted first by right in A1, R1, R2, R3, R4, and B1. Then BC, which is the business community, and then an I1, I2, and MHP zoning. What that is the accessory type scenarios for solar, and that's a 15 kilowatt, which we'll go over in detail here shortly. Then you have the breakdown of everything for uses permitted by special use permit. And the main district that you would see some of these in is in A1. In B1, BC, I1, and I2, we would have limitations on that, and they're minor scale and utility scale solar generation facilities. So I first want to start off by letting you know that our Sylvania County Schools and Sun Tribe Solar, who's here local in Charlottesville, that we had a very good partnership as the county, Sylvania County Schools and government and Sun Tribe Solar to get all five of our schools, Carysbrook down the street here, Central and West Central, Sylvania Middle School and High School. And actually the lower part of my comment there has been updated when talking to Mr. Wills today that it's not just some schools now operational, all schools now are operational. I haven't been in some of the inspections and fields things with them this summer. They've been wrapping those up. So all of our schools, to include the high school with them on the rooftop, and then at West Central, Mr. Wills indicated there's some limited rooftop applications. So what this has done for Sylvania County and a partnership with SunTribe Solar will carry our school system well into the future for energy sufficiency and sustainability. And so that was something that once when I arrived here 2 years ago that I really enjoyed working with Rich Alevi, who is the pre-construction and construction vice president and manager. We had worked with them, and also Bowman Consulting, who did a lot of the engineering work. They're out of Henrico County. So we're going into basically understanding the utility scale is the main thing that we're trying to work on and explain to you all tonight. These type of uses, properly conditioned and screened and buffered, are very passive land uses. They have low government service requests, low noise, low emissions, and solar energy production back into the electrical grid. So we don't have a lot of concerns in Virginia, but some of the other parts of the county, the country, do have concerns of brownouts and issues in Texas, California, and so some of those things that that are occurring to them now could happen to us in the future if, working with Dominion and CVEC and so on, we can strengthen the electrical grid. So these are the three solar definitions that we presented in the work session to the Planning Commission in April, and they recommended on to you all. We spent some time over the summer working with a lot of the utility scale solar folks who are interested, and they're actually working through the, it's called the PJM Dominion system, where they get into the system and go through the requirements at the state level and with Dominion and with their other providers, you know, other co-ops, like CVEC here. 85% of the county, as you all know, with broadband and energy coverage, is energy coverage for CVEC, and the other 15% is Dominion. So solar generation facilities, minor scale, that's less than 2 megawatts. The example of the one that you've seen so far is the SunTribe Solar one you all did in Cunningham Solar right there at South Boston, just outside of the roundabout heading towards CVS on your right-hand side. A lot of people in the community think that it was on the other side, on the Catholic Church side, because they cleared the property. No, they didn't clear-cut that property for SunTribe Solar's facility in conjunction with CVEC. So that first sighting scenario, SunTribe was very helpful in working with us to not have clear cutting going on, and they're going to integrate and put their facility behind the substation and in that area of trees, so that it does indirectly affect some of their solar saturation, but we felt it was important for it to be buffered and screened properly, and the neighbors that lived in that area appreciated that. So, and actually spoke at the, I think y'all's Board of Supervisors hearing. So,
what's the rough amount of acreage you said?
That was a very small tract. It was 67 acres. So we're looking at minimum tracts in the future to be around 70 to 75. So they were right around that time frame. The key for them was they needed to be right there at the CVEC substation. So it goes, the two, the 2 megawatts or less of electricity are ones that are generated right to kind of stay in our system, so to speak. So it's serving the county and somewhat central Charlottesville region. So
how do they cope with the cost on that solar energy?
You've asked that before.
I sure did.
Yes,
you did. Answer for it too.
Well, and one of the solar providers that I've been working with, and I'm not sure, he may be online tonight. He wanted to answer that question for you. So, Kurt Judy from Power 174 Global. So he's interested in answering that from an industry perspective, because I think that Mr. Gary Wood from CVEC said that it was a little complicated for
him. They couldn't answer it then.
Yeah, I understand. So, but if I can keep going on these definitions, okay. Mr. Weaver, I'm sorry.
I'll have some questions.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. So the small scale is the one that we're talking by right. So these are not more than 15 kilowatts of that electricity. They're really just systems that serve rooftop arrays for like our high school, like if it were an industrial building or a building like down in Zion Crossroads. It's only serving and being utilized by that building pretty much, or a grouping of buildings in an industrial park. So they're becoming self-sufficient. They're providing their own power within their own network. So we're not asking for them to go through any zoning approvals for that. It's provided that they do our normal buffers and screening as we normally would have them do in an industrial park to screen dumpsters and outside storage. The last one and the most important one that we're working with you all tonight is the utility scale solar. And that's 2 megawatts or more. And that's where we also worked are working with the community to understand some of these utility scale. I've actually been communicating with several individuals this summer out in the Shores Road, Rockfish Run area, where some people are interested, some providers are interested in doing this. So we've been educating them, and as of up to today, I was emailing information, and one person may come on tonight. So those are the three definitions. So recapping 15 megawatt, and here they are here, to break down the definitions so they're just straightforward. 15 kilowatts, small scale, that's your warehouse building or commercial use. Minor scale, 2 megawatts or less, like SunTrust Solar, or utility scale facilities of 2 megawatts or more, going into the overall power grid through an electrical transmission line. So you ask what electrical transmission lines do we have in the county? These are all ones crisscrossed throughout the county. Anywhere where transmission lines, like in the central western portion, where the lines are crossing, that's where they want to be. They want to be getting right back into transmission interconnects. And then also we're working down towards the area where we just worked with you all on the Dominion landfill this summer. We've had interest down north of the Dominion, right with the, if Eric, you can, Mr. Carl, you can go right there, just north of there where those two lines are crossing, and north of Bremo Bluff is where we have an interest of a smaller 45 megawatt facility that's interested in going generally in that. And that's the main one that we're currently working with individuals. We've had others we've worked on with about a year. So this is just kind of providing you, these are the panels that are that tilt and rotate with the movement of the sun and the curvature of the earth for solar saturation. And so also letting you know, what have we been doing up to this point, basically in the last 5 or 6 years. Major utility has been the definition. It's really not anymore suitable, meeting the Virginia General Assembly changes in the last few years. So we would like to work to get the major utility removed as well, because it really describes more and defines the reverse of that, the electrical transmission line process, as opposed to creating and generating energy, but it does work. It's been used for the purpose up to now. What we really want to do in order to come in compliance for the changes is this text, is the utility scale solar. And these definitions are basically coming from a lot of the state level definitions that DEQ and the State Corporation Commission. So we always try to keep these definitions in line with what the state's doing, so when they're going through and reviewing the requests, we're in compliance, and they don't have to ask us to change our definitions. So kind of recapping, minor scale, utility scale, they're mainly going to probably be occurring in the A1 zoning district for both uses, either the minor or utility. Like I mentioned, the solar, Cunningham Solar is the example. Utility scale, in the next 6 months to a year, we're going to start seeing more of those coming out of the queue for requests. And the one that most of you all have asked about and know about is the one up on Little Creek Road, just south. That's the Cornell Solar one that was done prior to me here. Oops. And that was the 15 megawatt facility. Just south, though, I'm sorry.
That's the one near Better Living?
Yes, sir. Yes, it's right there at Little Creek and Palmer Farm Road is on there. So that one actually, even though it's, I think there originally was concerns that it was in getting into our industrial park, but in actuality, on a land area, it might actually serve as a buffer between kind of industrial uses in the next 10 or plus years and residential that's already existing. So what we would like to do, Mr. Dahl knows that when we've talked to some of these providers in Charlottesville, Richmond, and some from the Carolinas that are doing it solar, these are some of the main tenets and things as far as siting guidelines. We do not want solar in community planning areas. It's to be avoided. Water and sewer areas, commercial and industrial areas. They have to, as Sun Tribe has demonstrated to you all, the environmental and historical analysis done by Timmons Group. We have large binders that get prepared, and Bowman Consulting and Warrior Engineering out of Luray has also done some work in this region. Community meetings, illustrating on a sketch plan so that people can tangibly see where things are going to be. And landscaping and site screening standards that we've talked about. And a lot of the times the ground covers to be pollinator friendly plants and native to Virginia. Or the mid-Atlantic, so to speak. So, and again, to let you know that this is basically where all of our community planning areas are. In areas that you see, that's the real much larger dark green in the rural conservation area, in areas where we can work with them to site things properly, that's where we would look for some of them to occur in limited fashion. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. Just recapping, we're just looking at three definitions and three types of land uses.
It's not clear to me how the zoning text amendment, sort of as you said, is working to, you know, avoid areas, as you mentioned, the CPA zones, where there's water and sewer. And you know, my frustration with what was passed at the Corona Farms there was that, you know, the county was investing an awful lot of money to build out what's ultimately a relatively limited amount of space that we have for commercial development. Mm-hmm. How does the ZTA address those concerns other than stating we don't want to do this? What's preventing somebody from actually still saying I want to put it in that CPA zone?
So the siting guidelines, if you're familiar with the last 10 plus years, the tower siting guidelines, we have currently in the back of the zoning ordinance, Article 27. What we're proposing to do once a lot of these folks, and prior to them coming out of the queue, most of them are going to start coming out of the queue in spring and summer of next year. We want to come back in the new year with some siting guidelines. We have worked with our consultants and different people that we've talked to in the industry relative to siting guidelines that are very similar. And Eric, if you can go back to the slide right before that. So we initially proposed 75 minimum acre tract and 750 maximum area, and the tract size and locations. And as far as what we're working on is we're trying to create the tower siting guidelines. We're waiting for a lot of the State Corporation Commission and the General Assembly changes to occur. We worked with Commonwealth Energy Partners out of Richmond recently, and they said that as of July, a lot of the changes are going in, and once people start coming out of the queue, we would have our what I call solar siting guidelines prepared and adopted for that. So the goal is to get applications brought through in a similar fashion to what we've been doing with, and I don't mean to keep saying Sunshine Solar, they're the only ones currently working with us. But we've also, I would say this, a lot of times the solar energy providers ask us, what is the client, what is the temperament or the climate for solar in your community? We're one of the smallest counties in Central Virginia and Virginia, other than Greene County. We do not have the land mass that a lot of times these people are looking for. You have to remember that and we have not had interest from individuals other than Virginia and the Carolinas up to the point, and then we started receiving interest from companies like Samsung and Power 174 Global. They're a California firm. So we've made it clear to them that our locality is not interested in having the large tract ones, and they've actually worked with us to find siting. The Power 174 Global has interest in going on top of our old landfill and remediating some of that as part of one of their projects that they would propose. And I don't know if Mr. Kurt Judy's going to talk tonight or if he's just listening to see what's going on. But he's out of based out of Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, and he's interested in finding out how this goes tonight, and then the siting that we look at with him and other companies.
Once it's rezoned, or is there a rezoning process or not?
There's no rezoning. It's a special use permit in most districts, but that's where, remember, you all are more in control of that as a special use permit conditions imposed as opposed to proper conditions through a rezoning.
Is that typical for most of the other counties where they don't require rezoning for this purpose?
Correct. That's right.
Mr. Miles?
Yes, ma'am.
In your report, you said that under fiscal impact, additional revenue may be received up to $1,400 per solar megawatt that is used. Can you explain that?
Sure. There's two options that I've discussed with Mr. Dahl, and we're going to in conversation with Chairman Sheridan. And so what you have is an option of $1,400 per megawatt times whatever that megawatt site is.
Per year.
Or per year. I'm sorry. Thank you, Eric. Mr. Dahl. Or larger counties who have more of a robust machinery and tool stacks type thing, they actually will look for the machinery and tool stacks and doing these different ratios. We are considering more the 1,400 megawatt per megawatt per year at this time.
That is something that's going to have to be formally kind of chosen by the board. You know, staff will come back to the board with a recommendation on that. So as Mr. Miles said, we'll be working with Mr. Sheridan, kind of going through, looking at, you know, what is the structure of our taxes and how would those solar assets be taxed versus if you're just to get a flat $1,400 per year for an infinite amount of time, you know, with some of our taxing mechanisms right now, stuff depreciates over time, so you know you may have something higher and then the value is going to go lower, or you can just get a flat amount for a certain period of time.
I thought they were exempt from taxation.
They're no longer exempt. Actually,
so they were, but they're
they
not.
Were. Yes, sir, Mr. O'Brien.
And so that's grandfathered in, correct?
So, for instance, the Cornell Solar one, 15 megawatts, that was standard we were doing in the last 5 years or so, 5 or 6 years. That was the issue with a lot of communities is they were exempt 80%. They're getting 30% federal subsidy taxes. So what were they doing? They were coming into communities and just laying out solar. And, you know, of course, the landowners, just like towers for the last 15 or 20 years, are getting revenue.
Right.
So this was an attempt from the delegates and the General Assembly to, especially in rural suburban counties, to gain some revenue.
So we don't know which way we're going to go. Do we have a choice?
That is, there's two choices. And
okay.
Yeah, well, staff will bring something back to the board after we go through and we do some analysis. And there's some other tools out there you can look at, and you know it's going to be based upon what is our tax structure for that type of equipment versus, as I said, do we just want a flat amount per megawatt per year for this infinite period of time?
Are they subject to the
utility? Did we receive anything from the solar farms that are here now?
No.
And that the taxation part will come directly to you at the board as a county code thing. It won't come through the planning commission.
So their grandfather, they wouldn't be part of that?
The 15 megawatt facility, yeah, it's indirectly somewhat grandfathered. As they change and upgrade things to swap out panels or whatever in the future, there may be changes. There's constant change going on to gain revenue from these facilities that was seen as a error on the General Assembly's part to do that. So I think it's an opportunity for localities to continue to have individuals like David Blount and at the TJPDC bring that up, and you all when we do our legislative breakfast and things like that.
So really this piece tonight, this is kind of really the first step to get the definitions in our zoning ordinance for what, you know, to really discuss utility scale solar, and there's going to be some additional phases from there looking at the taxation piece, looking at, you know, the size of, minimum, maximum sizes for these types of solar projects and stuff.
So right now, are they would under the new legislation, they're subject to real estate tax, machinery and tools tax, utility tax too, the way Dominion pays is now or not?
I don't know.
No, they're not. But I'm sorry, Mr. Bryan. They all, in any case, they're in working with Mr. Sheridan's office, and we let the property owners know who are negotiating with them. If they're in land use program, there is the possibility of rollback taxes, and that's to be negotiated with the individuals who are leasing the land to them for 50 years or 35 years, whatever the term they're looking at. So we proactively make sure in any discussions and community meetings that landowner or is aware of that. So, and a lot of times those people are letting them know that. But
and if the landowner is built, he probably has the right to pass that bill on to them and be reimbursed.
Correct, and that would be
paid for it.
Just like in towers in the past, general, there you're getting $1,500 a month to have the tower on your property for such a long time, and so the same thing applies here.
Yeah, just like if you have a rental property, you're generally probably going to pass on any increases in what your property is onto the person renting your property. So it's going to be similar.
Okay. And another question I had is you said rooftop arrays do not require zoning approval. Ground-mounted arrays require zoning approval as accessory structures. My question is the accessory use approved administratively?
Yes, we're kind of treating it like the panels are almost like a large storage shed, and they need to be setbacks because they're on the ground. They're a fixture or structure. When it's on the roof and it's behind a parapet wall or screened and you don't even see them, we're just having the building inspections department do electrical permitting and structural mounts. the one that's on the ground, and we actually prefer rooftop for some structure rather than one that's on the ground, but it just depends on the lay of the land and the tree cover and everything. So, but there's those two options. We're always trying to keep two options available. Long term, you're probably not going to see a lot more on the ground. Like in the old days, the huge satellite dishes, and then they became DirecTV dishes, and now they're like little tiny things. So the technology, we are really interested in getting everything mounted so it can't be screened behind the parapet wall, or like we did on high school in the West Central.
Two women bought part of my farm, the Hanum area, the old Hanum house, and they put a kind of like a wall up in one of the pastures with cell panels on it. They are being charged for the value in their taxes, overall okay. taxes. Is that correct?
I would assume so, and Mr. Sheridan's appraisals or whatever, or Pierce appraisals.
Yeah, they were complaining about that.
Okay.
My understanding was that is that because it was an array on the ground versus the fact that it was on the roof? Because my understanding is that for personal use, solar panel taxes didn't apply. I mean, there was not considered an improvement.
Yeah, I don't know that, sir. I can't answer that for you. I'm sorry. But generally, to answer everyone's question, we tried, and in really the last 8 to 10 years, we've tried to reduce all of the impediments or hoops or whatever you want to call them to get people to get solar on their own facility, their small farms. And now this is a whole nother opportunity or advancement to do it with solar in commercial or other larger settings.
And so, is there some way that you can find out more about how people get rid of their solar panels?
Yes. Yeah, well, actually, in Mrs. Morris' comments, there are actually, let me say it this way, in the western areas of the states, of the United States, there are decommissioning, or not really decommissioning, I won't say decommissioning, they're swap-out teams that go in and change some of these things. Relative to that, here in Virginia, as we were researching a lot of things about solar panels, VCU, School of Engineering, actually had designed solar panels so they're not highly toxic as much as the older ones were. And they also won a national or international award for designing it so that it would be so environmentally sensitive and also be the strong of saturation, so that kind of sweet spot of being not toxic and gaining the solar, the silica and everything that it's soaking up, because it's inside of that everything. Remember, everything in solar panels is glass and silica, and then the connectors that send the energy into the inverters and everything. So
you think they're safe to get rid of now? What about the old ones?
I'm really not here to kind of answer all those details for it right now.
I think.
I'm sorry, sir.
If you could look into that.
Yes, I will. I do know that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There are. We look to a lot of the people we're working with, and building trust and understanding. I will say this, in the 2 years that we've worked with SunTribe Solar, they are extremely environmentally concerned about what goes on in Charlottesville and they in the state.
Goes on? What do you mean by goes on?
How they develop their sites and how they look at long-term getting rid of things. So I can work with Richard Levy and some of the other folks that we're currently still working with and get some more of that tangible data relative to that. So I don't want to answer something partially in a partial manner. So
you said 5 schools had solar units. I'm really wondering what conditions that those were put up there, and how are they really saving money? What you see sometimes is not what you really see. For example, it's pretty well known that fossil fuels, that's the cheapest type of energy. And when we talk about putting windmills out in the oceans, and I'm off subject some, but there is another story. Windmills are one of the most expensive forms of electricity. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem with government. It's either subsidized someplace to make it look good, or it's too expensive for the average person actually to get involved with it. I've been involved with it. My daughter has been involved with it. And I tell you, it's all been subsidized. Mine was subsidized. Mm-hmm. Hers was subsidized. In fact, hers was, quote, supposed to have been subsidized. And it fell through, and she had to pay a tremendous amount. And it was not cheaper after it was all done and the contract was signed.
Yes,
so you really need to look behind the scenes.
Yes, sir.
And I'm a solar guy. Mm-hmm. I love solar energy, mm-hmm. as most people know. I had two on my house, and it heats the water up to 180 degrees. Mm-hmm. It'll burn you. So I like it, but it was subsidized. So when we say it's cheaper, somebody's paying the difference. That's all I'm saying.
Mr. Weaver, I'm right there with you. I'm cautiously optimistic about what we're doing in all of this thing, the activities with solar. And anyone in the solar industry will tell you that solar is not going to be the end-all to everything. It's just supplementing and providing additional.
That's right.
So,
but no, you're going to pay more for it.
Correct.
Maybe you don't see it on paper, but you are. The government's going to pay for it, one of the two.
Correct.
So, and the government usually doesn't care.
Taxpayer pays for it.
Taxpayer's so right.
When you argue that that oil is the cheapest way, that's one way to look at it. But when you take into account the environmental cost of oil, and then look at what has to be done when, we have flooding in urban cities and all those places have to be moved or changed or walls mm-hmm. built, that all gets passed on to the taxpayer.
Right.
So I don't think the oil company is paying for that.
mm-hmm. Yeah, but Mr. Weaver, you're correct. It kind of proves the point we were talking about earlier that we want to make.
What's that? Did you say?
Oh, I'm sorry, I was letting the chairman say.
I just said I think we're getting a little off topic.
Okay,
well,
yes, sir.
Finish your statement there.
No, I was just saying that before about when people are trying to lease solar from property owners,
uh-huh.
Just like you said, you always want to make sure your return on investment on your house, or some people now are building houses completely. That's the best way to do it, with solar built into the, into the roof line or
sure.
into whatever.
Absolutely.
So because you don't want to cut into a brand, like when we moved here, we had a brand new roof. DirecTV could have put a dish on my house, and I said, no, I'm going with Comcast. And he goes, yeah, that's what I'm going to tell you too, because I don't want to. So anyways.
Okay. Very good.
Yes, sir.
We're not reading that, are we?
Well, we got to see.
Someone's got to read it.
Someone's got to read it.
Presented as. Have you already done the public hearing?
No.
No, sorry.
Yeah, I remembered on y'all this time, buddy.
Yeah, I know. There wasn't a reminder slide in here for me.
Yeah, I was all over that. All right, hearing no other questions, we'll now begin the public comment. Anyone wishing to speak, please state your name and address. Keep coming direct to the board. Is anyone wishing to speak to this at this time? Ms. Harris?
No one is raising their hands.
Okay. Seeing none, I will now.
Yes, there's one.
Mrs. Rainer.
Ms. Rainer, did you want to speak to the public hearing on solar?
Yes, I do.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Okay, so I agree that, there is a cost to everything, and solar is not cheap. It is not the fix-all that it sounds like it will be. My question is, with all these solar panels on the schools, what is the savings to the school, to the taxpayers? What is the savings to the community when we put up these solar farms? How does that benefit the community? Because at the end of the day, the taxpayers pick up the tab, whether that's the federal, state, or local level, or all of them combined. So, if there is no benefit and it's just costing more money, I don't understand why we are investing in that.
That's part of our culture now.
Is that it, Mrs. Trainer?
No, that's not it.
Okay.
I agree with what Mrs. Morris had to say about the disposal of the old panels and how that is being disposed of. We don't know. Where is that going? In the landfills? I mean, I think there's a lot of unanswered questions about how this benefits. Like I said, is that lowering the energy bills for the schools? And is that being passed along to the taxpayers by lowering taxes? I mean, how exactly are we benefiting at the school level, at the community level? I just don't see it. So, I have a lot of questions too, just like Mrs. Morris. I think I echo exactly what her concerns are. But, you know, anything that sounds too good to be true is usually too good to be true. And I'm just not sold. I get that people think this is a cultural, you know, movement, but I don't see that. And that's just like the electric cars. I don't see that either. Because those massive amounts of batteries that generate massive amounts of heat goes in the landfill. And that is a tremendous replacement cost. And it goes right into the environment. So those are my concerns on the solar things. I have other concerns about other things, but I guess I don't get to speak about that now. Is that right?
Correct. This is dedicated to the solar issue, ma'am.
Okay. So those are my issues with solar.
Thank you, ma'am.
My questions and my concerns.
Appreciate you calling in. All right.
Okay. Can I just make one more comment about the subsidized? Whenever anybody says subsidized, that just really hits a point with me, because subsidized only means we're passing it on to the taxpayer.
Yes,
so
ma'am.
The taxpayer gets to pay, but they don't get the benefit. So I'm subsidizing as a taxpayer, and everyone else who pays their taxes is subsidizing solar energy, but they benefit in absolutely no way from that.
Thank you, ma'am. Is there anyone else wishing to speak at this time?
I don't see anyone.
No one, Ms. Harris?
No, I don't
see anyone. All right, I will now close the public hearing. Are there any other questions or comments from the board? Okay, do we have a motion?
I move that the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors adopts a resolution entitled "An Ordinance to Amend Chapter 22, Zoning of the Fluvanna County Code by addition of the definitions under 22-22-1, definitions use permitted by right in A1 zoning under 22-4-2.1, in R1 zoning under 22-5.2.1, in R2 zoning under 22-6-2.1, in R3 zoning under 22-7-9.1, in R4 zoning under 22-8-2.1, in B1 zoning under 22-9-2.1, in BC zoning under 22-10-2.1, in I zoning under 22-11-2.1, in I2 zoning under 22-12-2.1, in MHP zoning under 22-13-2.1, to permit a small-scale solar generation facility and uses permitted by special use permit in A1 zoning under 22-4-2.2, in B1 zoning under 22-9-2.2, in BC zoning under 22-10-4, in I1 zoning under 22-1-2.2, and I2 zoning under 22-12-2.2 to permit a minor.
Oops, hold on. Yeah, I was trying to make it smaller so you can see what.
To permit a minor scale and utility scale solar generation facility.
Second.
We got a motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mrs. Eager. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. We'll now move forward with the adoption of an ordinance approving the formation of a joint regional cigarette tax board. Mr. Dahl.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, we talked about this a great deal, so I don't want to belabor it too much. So again, some definitions from the Code of Virginia allows for local cigarette taxes. They're authorized. It was approved July 1, 2021 by the 2020 General Assembly. protect even more of the taxing authority as cities. We can localities can charge up to 40 cents per pack. And then it also, in the code, it talks about regional cigarette tax boards. And it talks about the authorization and the creation of those regional taxation bodies. Just as we discussed before, preliminary estimates show this tax could generate, once it's fully implemented annually, $190 to around $287,000 a year if a 40 cent per pack tax is approved. Again, in April 2021, the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission reached out to its member localities to see who's interested in forming a regional cigarette tax board. At that time, the Fluvanna board was interested, and they approved and passed a resolution on May 5th, 2021. And again, we've discussed this before, you know, through spring and summer 2021, there's been a cigarette tax work group kind of reviewing strategies and different implementation for this board. July of 2021, the TJPEC created a draft ordinance that all of these member localities that are interested in going into this regional body, they've been reviewing that. And again, we've brought in August the draft ordinance is now for the board's consideration for September. And again, as of today, five localities have adopted, and that's five localities, not including us, correct?
Not including us, and that's an assumption that they passed it last night. I didn't actually check that.
And again, in order to go into this regional body, you need six localities. In the localities that have expressed interest, I think there was eight in total that wanted to be into this regional body, but so far...
That's true.
What's that?
I believe that's true.
We have six now?
Yes, we should have six right now, assuming the board approves it. Yeah. And then, you know, again, you know, it talks a little bit about some definitions of regional cigarette tax boards, talks about the member locality, you know, discusses what the definition of a region in a region, regional cigarette tax board is. And then, you know, some of the things that a regional cigarette tax board can do, you know, talks about providing uniform stamping, entering into arrangements on behalf or in cooperation with member localities. The regional cigarette tax board kind of provides a single point of contact for stamping agents. And then again, you know, the regional cigarette tax board kind of administers and oversees all the taxation. Once the taxation comes in, then it distributes that taxation to the member localities that are a part of that. So like I said, without getting too much into the definitions and what is in the code, I think we've talked about this at great lengths here for a while now. But I would be happy to answer any questions, or if the board has any more specific questions. Really, if the board approves this, this is kind of the final stage for our board in to enter into the regional cigarette tax authority. After this point, there'll be some ordinance changes that we'll be working with Mr. Payne's and Mr. Tanner's office to get those ordinance changes. But this is proposed to be implemented around the first of the next calendar year, so January, and then you know, start collecting taxes in that period of time. And, you know, there may be a month or two delay, you know, because there's some old stamps out there and, you know, kind of getting the new stamps on board. And there's going to be some education for the retailers and the wholesalers and those localities that are part of this new cigarette tax board.
Was it $190,000?
It was $190,000 to $287,000 a year, yes. That's the estimate.
And how is that given out? Is it equally between the eight or six?
No, that'll be our share.
That's going to be our proration of it, yeah.
So it's not how many cigarette packs are sold in each?
No, yeah. Oh, yeah, it would.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, so the more people you have buying cigarettes, the more, because like I said, there's going to be stamps that are specific to Fluvanna County.
Okay.
So in other words, the better job we do in health class of talking people into not smoking,
the less we
cost us money.
That's good.
Yes,
but it's well worth it.
Yeah, it's good to talk.
Well worth it. Not for them to get cancer, right? Lung cancer.
No, it's well worth it to talk them out of it.
Yes.
No, my mother had COPD, and ultimately that was one of the causes of her death for 60 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well worth it.
So the motion is...
Hey, that's twice. Hey, Mark gets one on the calendar, Miss Harris.
I need to get people to put public here.
All right,
she did. I went right past it. I went right past questions.
All right. Are there any questions from the board for Mr. Dahl? All righty. Well, now open the public hearing. Anyone wishing to speak, please keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Is there anyone wishing to speak at this time?
There do not appear to be. No.
I'm not laughing at y'all. I'm looking down there. I see one. I show up. I see him with a cigarette quite often, but I'm not going to say anything. All right. I will now end the public hearing. Are there any comments or questions from the board? Do we have a motion?
I move the Board of Supervisors adopt the ordinance entitled Ordinance Approving the Formation of a Joint Entity Known as the Hoover Cigarette Tax Board and bestowing on such entity all powers necessary and proper for the performance of its duties as provided by law, and further authorize a county administrator to execute the Blue Ridge Cigarette Tax Agreement subject to approval as to form by the county attorney.
Second.
Motion's made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
I have to go home to my
nurse. Yes, ma'am. I thought about that when I looked over there. And chair votes aye. Motion passes 4-1. I love you, Chief. All right. D, resolution and public hearing for the issuance of Virginia Public School Authority Series 2021 bonds. Mr. Dahl.
And I'll go through this, and also on, I think we have a Mr. Sean Eichert who's with Raymond James. He actually called in, and so he should be on the Zoom meeting as well. So if you can.
Yes, he's unmuted.
Yep, he is unmuted. So I'll go through the presentation really quick. Mr. Eichert with Raymond James, he can certainly ask more specific questions. So again, the Board of Supervisors approved in the fiscal year 22 budget to issue $3.7 million for the debt fund school CIP projects. Again, VPSA, the Virginia Public School Authority, pooled financing program is likely the lowest cost of funds. It's a pooled bond program offering tax-exempt financing. Within that pooled program, it's rated AA+, AA1, AA2 by Fitch Ratings, Moody's, and Standards & Poor's, respectively. Also, it allows some customization for how we want those payments to be structured. Talking about public hearing requirements per Code of Virginia 15.2-2606, before the final authorization of the issuance of any bonds by a locality, the governing body shall hold a public hearing on the proposed bond issuance. A notice of hearing shall be published once a week for 2 weeks in the newspaper. We've done that in the Flumana Review for September 2nd and September 9th. And again, that public hearing should state the estimated maximum amount of the bonds, state the proposed use of the bonds, and specify the time and place of the hearing, which those ads did. Looking at the timeline a little bit here, so the Flumana County School Board, they adopted a resolution on August 11th. I've discussed this with the board about entering in and submitting a VPSA fall pool application that was submitted August 30th. And again, advertisements were put out for this public hearing September 2nd, 9th. Today is the resolution in the public hearing for the VPSA financing to authorize a resolution not to exceed amount of $4 million, a 20-year term, and a max rate of 3.5%. On the next slide, I'll talk a little bit more in detail on that. And also today, and within the next couple days, VPSA should be notifying us about again, the board, their board is considering the applications and the parameters of the sale. We actually had a due diligence call with VPSA, our financial advisors, our bond counsel, VPSA's bond counsel. I think it was about a week and a half ago. The week of September 20th and October 4th, we'll get some estimated debt service schedules, some preliminary debt service schedules to see what that looks like, what some preliminary rates are.
Where are we there on interest rates right now?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to be below 2%. And let me get to the one slide, okay, and sure. Then I'll talk about a little bit about rates on this as it stands. And then October 5th is the deadline for VPSA If this board wanted to make any changes to the amounts, to lower the amounts, we can't increase the amounts because we've already submitted the application. But if the board, for some reason, wanted to lower the amount or they wanted to completely withdraw the application, October 5th would be the deadline. So technically, since today is your only meeting prior to October 5th, you'd either have to make some mention of that today or we'd have to have a special call meeting. And then kind of in between October and November, there's lots of things behind the scenes, but November 9th is the closing on the local and BPSA bonds, and then the funds would be available. Again, looking at the breakdown of the project, again, in the FY22 budget, the board approved a little over $3.7 million, and that was the breakdown of those projects. Carysbrook Elementary School, $1.5 million. Abrams Academy, $1.25 million. School buses, a little over $1 million. After the schools have been getting some dollar amounts on some of the projects, the kind of the categories and the dollar amounts for each of those projects changed to fully do fully and best practice to do the Carysbrook Elementary School. That project is going to be about $1 million more. The buses are the same. We just rounded up BPSA applications. You have to round them to the nearest $5,000. So that's been rounded up to the nearest $5,000. And the Abrams Academy was lowered significantly because the schools have some ESSER funds, basically federal funds, that there's a lot of those funds they can use to do some of the upgrades to the schools, namely some of the water and sewer, ventilations and some other things. Dr. Gretz, the school superintendent, could talk more specifically about that. But again, the amount hasn't really changed. To talk a little bit about the rates, as Mr. Weaver was asking, so in our budget, we had budgeted for the FY22 budget and estimated conservatively for 10 years at 2.75%, which was the buses, 20 years at 2.6%, which was Carysbrook HVAC and Abrams renovations, the debt service would be roughly about $295,000 a year. If interest rates come in plus or minus a half percent, just so the board knows, it's roughly every half percent, it's $11,000 up or down in the debt service payment. Again, in this resolution, what the board has to approve, they have to approve a not to exceed, because once you approve this and once it goes to sale, let's just say, for instance, that the board said, you know what, we think interest rates are around 2% right now, but we don't want to authorize anything above 2%. Well, if it comes in at 2.01%, we can't move forward with it. So this is just really a not to exceed. So again, if the interest rates, say worst case scenario, the interest rates happen to come in at the 3.5% that's in this resolution, that would equate to roughly $20,000 more in the debt service payment than what is budgeted at the $295,000. I can tell you from speaking with Sean Eichert, and he can talk a little bit about some more specifics. Looking at rates today, they're below 2% right now. So, and speaking with them, you know, there is a little bit time to go before this closes, but we're not anticipating anything crazy. But again, anything can change in that time. But looking at where they are today, we're below 2%. So my half a percent, you know, we're going to probably be roughly, you know, $15,000 to $20,000 below what's budgeted for that. So. And I would be happy to answer any questions. And I know Sean Eichert. Sean, do you have anything you want to add as far as rates or the resolution in general?
No, I think you've covered it well. Happy to answer any questions. But yeah, I think at present, you know, interest rates have remained favorable here for a number of months now, and we're hopeful that they will continue to be favorable. Mid to late October, when the bonds are sold and those rates can be fixed.
All right. Any questions for anyone? Thank you so much for tuning in tonight. We appreciate you being here. If I hear no questions, I will now ask, do we have a motion?
Public hearing.
Oh, you got me this time.
Daggone.
All right. I will now open the public hearing. Anyone wishing to address the board, please keep your comments 5 minutes. On topic and directed to the board. Is there anyone wishing to speak at this time? Ms. Harris?
I don't. There doesn't appear.
Okay, hearing none, I will now close the public hearing. Do we have a motion?
And again, please look at the screen. I just put one little kind of clarifier on there in red, but otherwise it's basically the same motion.
I move the Board of Supervisors approve the resolution entitled Resolution Authorizing the Issuance of Not to Exceed $4 Million General Obligation School Bond of the County of Flavanna, Virginia to be sold to Virginia Public School Authority and providing the form and details thereof, which shall be for a term not to exceed 20 years and bear an interest rate not to exceed 3.5%.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. All righty, folks. We have no action matters. I see no appointments. We are on to presentations. Community Investment Collaborative Loan Fund Update. Stephen Davis, President of the Community Investment Collaborative.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm Stephen Davis with the Community Investment Collaborative. As you hopefully are aware and remember from previous times I've addressed the board, CIC, we are a what I used to say is a microenterprise development organization, but as of January of this year, we are a certified community development finance institution. CDFIs are a U.S. Treasury Department certification to help under-resourced and underserved communities throughout the nation. And so that certification says that we follow good lending practices and specifically serve those communities. And so that certification is a big opportunity for CIC to serve the region. Flavanna being a leader in setting up your loan fund 9 years ago was a helpful contributor to helping us get that certification. So that's one big change. The other change that you've probably heard, we are also now the host, as of January of 2020, of the Central Virginia Small Business Development Center. So they are part of our operation. And so you hear from maybe Rebecca Haydock, our director, at times about the SBDC and its service. And I'll give you a quick update on that in a few minutes. Move on to the next slide, please. Just a reminder, our core programs are education, 16-week workshop, we offer microloans of up to $35,000, mentoring and networking opportunities for entrepreneurs who are starting and growing businesses. I can go into much more detail on all of those, but I'll just give you updates on what we've been achieving. Next slide, please. The big number that I kind of point out a lot, for every dollar CIC has spent since our creation 9 years ago, we've returned $5.65 and wages from new jobs have been created from businesses. And that's just the wages. That doesn't count all the economic activity that those businesses have. And so we've created, as you can see on the metric there, 203 full-time equivalent jobs have been created. Not all of them have survived, you know, but still that number, the number of surviving jobs is around 175, 178, but they did exist for 1, 3, 4, or 5 years, depending on the business and that they were in. So that's the big picture of what CIC has achieved. What we've been doing specifically in Flavanna County, here on the next slide, across our programs, you can see it. This is a slide that shows you the number of clients served in Flavanna County since we started in 2012, starting at 2 entrepreneurs in our very first workshop, and then each year you can kind of see the growth, and there was some significant growth in the last couple of years, both in our 16-week workshop as well as across the other programs. So that's a big part. We've continued to see that, and I'll tell you a little bit about how we've gotten there as well. But the big part of my update tonight, and that was also included in your materials, was an update I sent this summer that's a part of our MOU with Flavanna County about our loan fund. So it was originally a $45,000 loan fund created back in late 2012, early 2013. You modified the conditions on it a couple years ago to allow us to lend to a broader base of Flavanna businesses, basically not restricting it to only people who do our workshop, but other businesses who've been operating for 6 months. And so for a number of those years, up until that update a couple years ago, we had not fully deployed that fund ever. We had done about 30,000 in loans out of the 45,000, and so it has been underutilized. Last year, you gave permission to allow us to use some of those funds to do as a part of the, what we call the Fluvanna Recovery Fund, which is a larger part of the larger Regional Business Recovery Fund, to do loans for businesses impacted by COVID-19, providing at that point last year emergency working capital for businesses who had, you know, suffered injury and needed that money to kind of get through the really rough last summer that existed in the business community. And we had used that to do, I think it was 4 loans last year with those funds specifically. And then flash forward this year, we've done a couple more loans with that recovery fund for folks who are kind of ideally, hopefully, not going coming out of the impacts from COVID with their businesses. But a lot of businesses have significantly spent down reserves or delayed equipment purchases or those types of things. So the second round of recovery loans has helped people do that. Purchase a piece of equipment that they maybe delayed last year, or replace a piece of equipment, or do other things to that around delayed purchases because of COVID. So for the first time this summer, I can say the loan not only went past being fully deployed, but it's fully deployed all at one time. You know, so all out. You know, payments are coming back, but you know, for you know the couple of months in here, there was no funds available specifically from your fund. We do have another Fluvanna loan application right now, but we have other funds that are available through the broader region, so we're still able to serve them, but all of your funds are being put to work. So as the chart shows there, you can see currently where we are. Literally as of August 31st, it was $350 or more payments on September 1. So there's a few more, so it'll keep going up. All of the recent loans are performing. So all the loans made last year are performing. We had one loss from the fund going back to one of the early loans in 2014, but to date, all the more recent ones are performing. So that's the loan fund. A couple other notes, we've had 51 people who participate in our program since we launched who are residents of Fluvanna County. Not all of those residents started businesses in Fluvanna County. Some of them, based on what their business was, chose Charlottesville or Albemarle or Louisa, depending on where what worked for them and what they were doing. The list up here is a partial list of folks who have went through the program or had a loan who did start businesses in Fluvanna, and it's a partial list. There are more others. So I just wanted to give you a quick list of those because I know you'll recognize some of the names. And I'm happy to share others. For CIC side of the program, we have, when they do a loan with us, they give us permission to share that they have a loan with us. We would not share any proprietary information, but we are able to disclose that. Next slide. One quick update from last year, if you remember that you used a lot of CARES Act money to do small business grants. Again, separate from the loan fund, grants to help businesses that had been impacted by COVID-19. And so Fluvanna County and the EDA contracted with CIC to manage that grant process. You were one of 11 municipalities that worked with us. So last year, we helped 11 municipalities make 800 grants to businesses and organizations for nearly $12 million, all in 6 months, you know, working remotely. So it was quite a year. But this is what we did in Fluvanna County, includes a number of inquiries, number of applicants, and number of those who were approved, both for the business grants and the specific nonprofit grants that you approved last year. And then your team here has that complete list, you know, as far as everyone who received funding. I think it was even posted online last year when the grants were made. Just a reminder that it had happened. And then one other piece of this year, part of our growth, next slide, please. The Fluvanna EDA approached us about providing scholarships for entrepreneurs to participate in our 16-week program. They had secured a grant, and I don't have from memory remember where they received that grant from.
I think it's CACF, I think.
Oh, was it a community foundation grant?
I thought it was.
Okay, so, yeah. But I know they secured it, and they use it for several things to help businesses locally, but one was to help entrepreneurs participate in our program. And so that is part of the uptick you saw this year in Fluvanna residents and businesses participating in our 16-week workshop, that there was 7 this spring, and again, 7 who are participating as we speak tonight, but they're in the middle of the program right now. And the last, just a quick update on the SBDC. I'm sure you'll hear from Rebecca Haydock later in the fall at some point. But we took over the SBDC, you know, back in January of last year. It was quite a year for SBDC. This was all the support they provided to small businesses. The SBDC has tripled its amount of service since 2019 as far as number of hours and clients served across their region. But I'll give you a quick update on the next slide as far as number of clients served in Fluvanna. We've just recently passed the total, the number for all of last year, and it's still early September, or I guess mid-September now, and number of client hours served. The capital formation is folks that we've helped secure loans, and so this would SBDC helping secure loans through banks or other sources of financing. And so the total for this year is still, we haven't collected it all for it, but you can see both last year and this year's numbers on it.
One quick question. Is are those fiscal or calendar?
These are calendar years. Okay. So we can get that update on the fiscal as we go, because it does adjust significantly. With that, the last slide just goes to give you a couple minutes for questions if you have them. A couple of programs and opportunities happening right now, if you know for real. So our loan fund and recovery funds are still available. So if you have know of folks who are growing the business or have been impacted and need loan fund, CICs are available. And so please have them reach out to us. Our entrepreneur workshop, we run twice a year, so the next one will start in the spring. Applications will open in November. And another program that we work with, that the SBDC is running, that we worked with a number of counties in the region, and the Go Virginia program at the state level, is a website jumpstart program. So if you know businesses that are significantly trying to expand their digital presence by selling online and don't have access to sites, this is a program to get a free starter website that can actually help you get started selling online. And so the link is in the slide and available on the Central Virginia SBDC website if folks are interested, that we will help them achieve that. So I just wanted to leave you with a few things that we're doing. So I talked very fast, I know, but I'm happy to answer your questions.
Are there any questions?
No. I was just going to say, I bet it's really tough giving out all those grants. And I'm just joking.
Yeah, of course. Trust me, you would think it would be very easy to give out grants, but as you can see from the chart there on there, that we had lots of inquiries and a lot across all of the grants. Only half the people completed an application. And it was, some of people not wanting to share private information, some of people who think that if they shared it, they would get in trouble, and we're not sharing any of that with anyone, beyond what's required by auditors, to, verify we did what we said we did. So it was harder than you think, I guess is my point, we looked at those grants. It was the opposite of reviewing a loan. With a loan, we look for evidence that the business is growing and can repay the loan. For the grant last year, the specific CARES Act requirements, we had to certify their economic injury. So we had to show that they had been hurt by COVID. And so seeing some of that injury was challenging at times, because a lot of businesses took some very big hits, in those first 6 months. So
I'll just tell you, I put one in with the driving school. Uh-huh. But my problem was I worked too much when they put us back to work in June. I worked too much during the month of June. Yeah. So I ended up almost making in June what I made in April, May, and June the year before.
Yep. And that the timing of things made a big difference. Some people who were injured couldn't qualify because we had to create a test that we could defend in an audit. And that test was, comparing one year to another, and we did our best to give people a couple ways to qualify, but short answer, it was harder than we'd like it to be.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I knew a couple of people who couldn't qualify, and I always think about what can you do differently to reach down even lower, because the people with the greatest need, they're the ones that never come to the top.
I
don't know how you get there, because, like you said, they don't want you to pay taxes in years. They don't want you to know all of that. And so they'd rather struggle than to put their personal stuff on the line so they can move up. So you need some psychologists to work with these people.
And if folks were willing to try, we went to bat for a number
it's
of people.
It's a trust factor.
Yeah, that's the trust, and that helped with some of the folks that CIC had worked with previously because mm-hmm. they knew us and would trust us. But it was still challenging, and I think you serve up your example, and I know that like that was an issue of folks who had whose employees were contractors. Right, the contractors are technically another business, and so if the requirements for some of the programs had requirements as employees, they didn't count if they were 1099 contractors.
Because one of the people that worked for me mm-hmm. got more money than I got to do the thing because she was a contractor.
Exactly, and she had records. So right. yeah, so yeah. So yeah, but that it was a. Quite a year, I think, for all of us in many ways, and this was just another example. But we're continuing to work on all of these fronts. So, happy to, the partnership, I always share that Fluvanna County was the first community in our region to create a microloan fund with us. So we appreciate y'all's support and hope to continue growing that that support for businesses in Fluvanna County.
We appreciate your hard work.
Thank you.
Y'all all right. Have a, evening. Have a great, safe trip home. All righty, next up is the consent agenda. F, minutes of September 1, 2021. G, priority dispatch system contract with Stoller. H, accounts payable report for July 2021, Ms. Melton. I, accounts payable report for August 2021, Ms. Melton. J, proclaiming October as Community Planning Month, Mr. Miles. And K, CRMF, FCPS, FCHS, HVAC, Chiller's Capital Reserve Maintenance Fund Request, Mr. Stribling. And having said that, that's one thing I'm better say before I forget. They have asked a lot of questions, I notice it's not part of the consent agenda, about what's going on with the schools and their solar. So that's something we reach out and get up.
Yeah, we could
get an update.
Yeah, we could have Mr. Stribling or Mr. Gretz, Dr. Gretz come out here and give an update on the solar project. And I know Mr. Weaver asked, how is it from a cost and benefit standpoint? How did they?
Sure, there has to be a mix someplace.
They are
which I don't understand.
I don't know the specifics. They did certainly tie into a contract and lock in a low energy rate, and I don't know what that is.
I can tell you right now, when I walk by those, I guess they're batteries, I don't know, that collect everything from the panels on the back side of the football field at the middle school, those things are humming like a beehive.
Yeah.
I just hope my hair doesn't start turning.
Yeah. I'd like to pull Jay.
Jay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Proclaiming October's Community Planning Month. I think a lot of those proclamations and resolutions and things are so important that the public read them. Because, there have been some concerns about the comprehensive plan, of whether there's been enough community involvement. And we need, when you read this, the original plan in 2015, when we rewrote it, we did pull together, when we first started off 10 years ago, we pulled groups together the first time we had the comprehensive plan. And then as we moved forward, I remember Thomas Jefferson plan, we had someone to update it. We were updating it within the 5 years, and we don't do another total rewrite of it. So there is a lot of community input, but how can we improve that? How can we satisfy that some people are saying that we are moving forward and not letting the public be involved? In our resolution it says, whereas the full benefits of planning requires public officials and our residents to understand, support, and succeed. Expect excellence in planning and plan implementation, and to also participate to have a better future, and so forth and so on. That's what we say in the resolution. Are we doing it? And if we're not, then how can we?
Yeah, Mrs. Booker, like, So as you stated, you know, the comp plan that's happening right now, it's not a full rewrite.
Yeah,
it's an update. And Mr. Miles, I think he's out in the hallway.
Yeah.
He could talk a little bit about it. But we've talked about this. You know, there's a lot of studies and things that have been happening kind of, I don't want to say behind the scenes, there's things that have been happening mm-hmm. that are not behind the scenes. You think of the Zion's Crossroads small area plan. There was a survey that went out to the public that wanted to gain feedback on what they want or what they valued in the Zion's Crossroads small area plan. That is going into the comp plan.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Central Virginia Regional Housing Partnership. They did a regional housing study. There was public feedback solicited for that. That piece of that is going into and in addressing the comprehensive plan. We did a resident survey that Ms. Harris did that went out to lots of people. We got lots of feedback. That citizen engagement, pieces of those are going into the comprehensive plan. And there's a couple others that are just drawing your
leg.
I think a senior housing study,
sure.
things like that. We have requested public input on those things. And if you're talking about we're not getting public input, we've requested public input, and those components are going into it. Now, Mr. Miles, they're at the phase where they're kind of putting all that together,
mm-hmm.
and the comp plan will be going out as a draft form for the public to comment on.
Right.
So, like I said, we're not doing a full-on, from the ground up, a major rewrite. We're doing some slight tweaks and updates, but not much. But it's more so including these different other mm-hmm. studies that have been occurring into the comp plan.
Thank you.
Well, in theory, and again, as Mrs. Booker has pointed out, there's a lot of people that are expressing their concerns about the growth that they see in the area, and there's a lot of confusion about it because they are sort of assuming that we're not paying attention and trying to follow the goals of the comprehensive plan and maintain the rural character and so on, as has been stated. But I think part of the frustration comes in that the process of bringing the comprehensive plan together, tweaking it as you say, but tweaks can be changing the size of a CPA zone, tweaks can be changing working towards changing cluster subdevelopments and so on. The public can provide the input. They have the ability to do that by going to the planning commission meetings, stating their concerns, meeting with the planning commissioners, and doing the same thing when it comes to the board of supervisors and or in advance of that. I suspect that one of the challenges is that you don't look for it. Maybe we need to do two things going forward. Is one, advertise for a group, a committee that reviews what the planning commission is suggesting and provides their comments and feedback. And two, advertise what chapters are being worked on at the planning commission meetings in advance. And when I say advertise, I mean everybody knows there's a planning commission meeting, but something as important as maybe the comprehensive plan, there's that opportunity to say, let us, we will be reviewing over the next 3 weeks, rural subdevelopments, as an example. And so then folks can show up if they want to do that and comment and participate more actively during the planning commission meeting. So the planning commissioners can hear their concerns. So, I think that's, that had been brought up that in the previous comprehensive plans there had been kind of a community committee. And then in the last, at least I think in 2015, there wasn't, and certainly it doesn't sound like it.
Yeah, Mr. Miles, talk about what?
I'm sorry, I was talking to the solar folks.
Sure.
I apologize.
Do you want to talk about a little bit about what's coming up on the comp plan? What's opportunities for the community
for input
from a planning commission piece and?
Yes. So last night we had Sandy Shackelford present the what we hope is the final version iteration of the Zion Crossroads. Gateway Plan, and so a lot of
the Zion's Crossroads small area plan,
and basically what's happening with that part of that component of the comp plan is Louisa is going on further studying traffic analysis of Route 15 and 64 and north of in that portion, And we've been trying all along to focus on the 250 corridor, which is basically our area. And so,
But I guess maybe talk to the board a little bit about, so what are the opportunities for the public to have input into the comp plan itself? Because as I talked to the board, there's been all these different studies that have been done,
right,
that the public's had the opportunity to you know, fill out the surveys and know it's not, you're filling out the survey for the comp plan, but you're filling out these studies and surveys because these things are going into the comp plan. Now we're putting, and you're updating the comp plan. How is that? When can they do that? What's the time to do that? When's the Planning Commission looking at that?
Yeah, so what we're going to do in October, as Chairman Bibb, is as people who have expressed interest over the summer and into the fall here to be appointed to certain committees, that's what we're going to work on in October's work session with Chairman Bibb to create those. We created the Transportation Subcommittee over the winter and into the early spring, into the summer, up to June 10th, took care of a lot of that. So now what we're looking at is, and I've gotten worked with folks through FLDP and some of the other folks who express interest in the community, is to get those things set up and appointed, and then start working on what I call the components of the comprehensive plan that we would have as different chapters. And then, as Mr. Dahl indicated, there's a lot of studies that are just going to be referenced and integrated. The comprehensive plan currently is 170-some pages. It's not going to be that big. All of the new comp plans in the region, 2035 and 2040 ones, you're usually looking at reference documents of 45 to 50 pages. So the goal now for doing comp plans is to create them as summary documents and have things, and a lot of them very interactive on people's websites. If you look at Goochland's, Greene County is currently revising and updating theirs so that you can gain the information and the consultants or developers can go in, or anyone really, people who work for Ravana River conservation groups or anything, can go into the different documents and utilize them for their needs.
So are the upcoming chapters advertised on the county website? So that there's kind of a guideline that people can go look at and say these are the issues that are going to be discussed, you know, over the next
months. So we're going to take the current vacant webpage, Mrs. Harris and I, it's called the Community Development page. It's kind of like a framework page, and make that the comprehensive plan portal or module area so that we can have those documents available for folks. And those committee members and different people would be providing those, providing comments back to us at monthly meetings at the Planning Commission work sessions.
And talking to a lot of residents, I just expressed that as Board of Supervisors and from the standpoint of the community, what we write and what our comprehensive plan is a guideline that we follow, in essence, to say this is to investors, to people that are moving to the community, to people that want to develop into the community, that this is the framework under which, generally speaking, we're going to operate in.
Mm-hmm.
And it reflects poorly, ultimately, I think, when we don't follow the comprehensive plan as an overall community. And I understand that when people are suddenly seeing a lot of change, that they become very concerned about it. But you have to redirect them to say, but these are the frameworks that we're trying to operate within, and here's the process that we do. So it's an important process, and I think we just need to make it as publicly transparent and available as possible.
Yeah, and I think, too, there's been some comments that, you're talking about this and it's not the comp plan. Well, we only update the comp plan every so often, and so there's going to be a few times where something may not be in the comp plan, but it doesn't mean it's not something that the board or the community doesn't value as a whole. Example, we're working on the Fourth Union Business Park. Mm-hmm. That's not on the comp plan, but it's something that's going to be of a good benefit to the county and a great value. So yes, there are times that things are not in the comp plan, but it doesn't mean we can't move forward with something.
Absolutely, and that's why I said generally speaking.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so on your point earlier, Mr. O'Brien, The other thing that, since I've been here and when I interviewed and looked at the current comp plan, it's very voluminous and very design guideline related in some aspects, which isn't a problem. That's not an issue. But implementation and goals and activities that are part of it, really, one, can be more streamlined, and that's what we're doing. And two, the main thing, and I'll tell you, working with Sandy Shackelford, Nelson County has the same mapping, what I call nodal stars or whatever, that show you like at the intersection of 53, where the Colonial Circle roundabout is. That's like the community mixed use node and everything. At times, there's people who are wanting to see actual parcel level or semi-parcel level designs of where they want to be. The Nelson County folks are updating next their comp plan. And there have been issues that she's actually, when she was a former planning director, has gone back to work with individuals where, unfortunately, they challenged that you couldn't see what was in that area and so forth. So the goal is to make sure that we have, you know, clear and concise areas where we want, and the main thrust in working with Mr. Dahl and all the documents that we have been doing, the studies and things, is to make it clear that commercial and industrial, as I spoke last night in reference to the Village Gardens request, that's our main focus right now coming out of the new comp plan. There was really not an issue or concern that we're looking at changing any of the agricultural preservation or residential and the densities. I think there's been this slight misconception in the community in the last few months that the R4 text amendment that we had earlier was trying to change the comp plan without the new comp plan. It wasn't that at all. So I want to let people know that we're really not looking at changing, because a lot of the things that are going on with the density in some of the community planning areas, there's just not the water or sewer in right now in some of those areas, and there will be in the near future, in the next 5, 7, 10 years. So the goal is to finish the Zion Crossroads plan, get that integrated in there, and then work on trying to link all these other studies in. I will tell you first and foremost, I was just back there talking to them about their solar project, and theirs is gonna actually be a fairly large one. I said, we are going to have to meet with the community about this and the Planning Commission and Board for quite a while. So again, the same thing that we're interested in doing with the comp plan. It's just been so frustrating through COVID and things, and not being able to do that. But I think we've done, Ms. Harris did the resident survey, and we've done all kinds of other Zion Crossroads business surveys. But as I provided an email to Mr. Dahl and someone who inquired recently, I did a fairly solid summary of where I felt we were at. So, and trying to get moving on putting together some, you know, strong elements of the comp plan and framework. So there's been a lot of, I'm trying to let you know, I'm not trying to make excuses or anything. There's been a lot of work that's been going on. It's sure. Just all of these regional housing chapters thing, have just occurred, that we were supposed to get the regional housing stuff in January of 2021, and we got it in July of 2021. So everyone right now is about 6 months behind, but I've worked with Sandy Shackelford and indirectly Christine Jacobs to let's get as many things as we can get done. We knew, and I'm trying to, I know it's a public forum, but we knew VDOT and their consultant was taking a long time, and we asked to be separated from that. Right. And that's now occurred. So,
I was involved in the 2015 comprehensive plan as being on the Planning Commission as a commissioner, and I know that it's a lot of, as a supervisor, I know that there's an awful lot of work that goes into the comprehensive plan and the creation of it, and by the planning department. So, yeah, certainly appreciate all your hard work.
Yes, sir. I apologize. I understand. I was actually going to indicate before I finished the solar one. Thank you for allowing us to proclaim October. And then, Mr. Dolan, I kept it as, continuing recovery, but we're also kind of thinking of this as our year for the comp plan to be finished and going into 2022. So, I forgot that was on consent and it got pulled, so I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Miles.
All right, yes, sir. Is there anything else that needs to be pulled?
I was going to ask some questions here.
H or I?
It's going to be on G.
Okay. The contract.
Yes. In this, let me get my orientation here. It indicates that the total contract of $88,905, there was some mistakes or whatever. It says, since the board approved the contract asked for some changes to be contract wordings.
Yeah, I mean, so there were some, and I apologize, Ms. Toller's not here. Again, the board approved this contract previously. There was just some language in the contract that between the county attorney's office and Priority Dispatch, they had to make some changes, and it didn't change the dollar amount, but it was more to language. And
well,
just
it did change the dollar amount from what I had there.
Let me see here.
Changed it by $950.
Let me see here.
see the bottom paragraph.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, it looks like it looks like there was a change.
I mean, what?
Yes, it looks like there was a $475 change.
$950 total for the last 2 years.
Yes, for the last 2 years. That is.
So we're doing this over again because something wasn't right to begin with. So I was wondering, who changed the contract? Did the people who medical priority, did they change the contract after we signed it, or did we change the contract? What's going on there,
Mister?
Didn't they were going to charge us the first year, and they decided that's taken out. They're not charging for the first year.
That's been that way. Okay. That was a way to begin with. That's not the debate. The debate is the last 2 years.
Okay. Well, I thought that was the change.
No, because we're talking about $950 difference. So the question is, did we make up a contract wrong and put a wrong figure in it, or did they raise the price on us and didn't want to sign the contract that we gave them before?
Mr. Weaver, I apologize, I don't have the specific answer.
You know what I'm talking about now?
No, I see what you're saying, and I don't know if it was something that maybe got misconstrued on our end as we were putting forward to the board, or whose side it was on.
I thought I remembered them going up at the end of like that before. Don't ask me to remember the numbers.
Well, it's done. If you remember that, then it should have been in the original one and not have to be done over for us to approve it now.
I don't know. I mean, the only thing we can say is, I mean, if there's some concerns with it, we can pull it.
There's a contradiction there. So, you know, it's I find it strange that nobody could really respond to that, yet we're to go ahead and approve this $88,905. Okay, I'll go ahead and approve it this way, and then you can get back with me. So
Ms. Toller, she just texted me, and she'd been notified. So the contract always had that amount. It was her mistake when she presented the information.
That's fine. No problem.
Yeah. I just, okay.
Okay. It was a human error.
Yeah, well, we all
made it. I can't believe that.
Yes.
I haven't made a mistake.
Yes, and again, because there was some discrepancy, we thought it important to put the correct version before the
law. Absolutely. Okay. She makes that mistake again, she's got to pay for it.
Don't worry about a thing, Ms. Toler. I've already gotten Mr. Dahl twice tonight. Okay. Anything else, Mr. Weaver?
Well, we have to get the bills here.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, I move that the accounts payable and payroll be ratified for July 2022 in the amount of $8,753,000, $753,062.64.
Say that again.
My tongue's all tied up.
It was
$8,753,062.64.
Good. Yeah. Thank you.
All right. How's that?
That's
and also move that the accounts payable and payroll be ratified for August 2022 in the amount of $3,781,617.29.
Very good.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Ms. Booker. Mm-hmm. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0.
This included F. Sue K. I didn't mention that. That includes minutes and all this.
Yes, sir. And you can tell the difference in the big payment that we make in July. Yep. So you said the $8 million to the $3 million. Right. That's a $5 million payment.
Yeah, only $5
million. Yeah, July is when, right, yeah. July is when we have the big majority of all our debt service payments.
Yes. All right. Now we're going to unfinished business, the burn building, Mr. Dahl.
Yes, so I'll try and be quick on these things. So we've been working on the burn building for a while, and Ms. Smith should be on the line here too. We've been working on this for a while, and as you know, we put bids out, we got them back, the price didn't go down, we retweet things, trying to get a lower bid, we put it back out. You know, basically the price has come back the same the whole time. We submitted, and with Mr. Ben Powell, who's kind of the project manager and a former firefighter that's been working on the burn building project for the county, we submitted a letter to the Virginia Department of Fire Programs to see if there's a way that, you know, other localities are having some of these challenges too. The costs have gone up, they're putting out for burn building grants, and so we put a request to see if there's a potential to get any funding increase from the state for the grant itself.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, so they had reached out to us that they are going to consider our request, so I'm going to be going to the Virginia Fire Services Board meeting next week to kind of talk about the history of our project, where we are, you know, what we've done. You know, we've been doing everything right, and we've been trying to stay within the grant requirements, but things haven't changed with the pricing on it. So trying to see if there's a way for either on a onesie-twosie basis for them to increase our grant amount, or from a policy standpoint, those other localities that are having the same issue that we're having, is there a way for them to change the overall funding amount for the program for these types of buildings? So really my question to the board is, so we had a $450,000 grant from the Virginia Department of Fire Programs. We had a $30,000 grant for some like engineering. That's been spent and done. Up to this point, you know, I think some of the estimates that we have seen, and I don't have the current amount for what the current estimate is, because again, remember, the board authorized us to go and redesign it again to basically make it bare bones, but so it still meets the grant requirements. But, you know, we hesitated putting it out because, one, costs of just not material costs and then labor costs have not been where they are. We're going to be at a point, though, here really soon that we're going to need to make some type of movement on this. We're either going to have to say, look, we're going to pony up. Well, here's the thing. We're going to go to the Virginia Department of the Fire Services Board meeting and request additional funding. If they request, if they offer or allow some additional funding, I am certain it's not going to be the difference from what we already have versus what the project cost is coming in. So as it's been standing right now, the board has kind of always approved, it's been roughly around 250 to 300,000. The board's always kind of talked about approving from fund balance for this project. So with the 250 to 300 plus the grant of 450, that's, you know, roughly around $750,000 is where we thought the total project cost was going to come in. Well, it hasn't come in that amount. Is there, and again, I don't think that the Virginia Department of Fire Programs is necessarily going to say, look, you know what, I mean, we can request it, that they're going to cover that additional $250,000 shortfall in the grant program. So really my conversation from the board is, and I'm not necessarily looking for a formal action, but just a conversation before I go to this meeting, is there any intent to increase that funding amount anymore? And certainly, you know, because I'm going to kind of have to give the Fire Services Board some indication on where we are with this project and how we think we're going to move forward with it. I mean, if they say, well, look, we'll give you an additional $50,000, well, $50,000, that's gonna still keep us a long way from completing the project if the project comes in at 950. So at some point, we're either just going to have to say, look, we're either going to bite the bullet and we're going to pay the difference, or we're just going to have to return the grant and not move forward with it.
Is there any way to work any COVID in there? I mean, it's probably out of the question, but is there anything?
Or what's left over from CARES?
CARES is, we only got like $3,000.
Oh, I thought
it was more than that. Okay. It's like $3,000 for finishing up. And from ARPA, no. I mean, again, ARPA is not generally for infrastructure, only for water, sewer, and broadband infrastructure. And again,
I think public safety might be one of those things where that might classify, because all those things that you're talking about, broadband, water, and sewer, all public issues.
We need to work it in some way.
I'm not sure how do you, again, and this is, you know, there's been certain discussion on this, how do you work burn building into, how does it relate to COVID?
I don't know.
I don't see it, but that's just me.
Well, I think one thing to look at too is that ultimately, you know, we're able to do certain things with the ARPA money, freeing up money to do other things.
So, yes.
I mean, we're blessed to have ARPA.
We'll be able to get it back somewhere. Yeah, that's so, where you search.
Yeah. Well, if you think about what we did with CARES, we were able to offset a lot of public safety payroll salaries, human service salaries for those roles that were integrated into and potentially, you know, the CARES language was a lot more open and lenient for offsetting payroll expenses. So yeah, we probably put back into the general fund, you know, $2 million.
I think it's 2.1. I bet a lot of fires are started by cigarette smokers. Okay. You know, and so we can apply the tax that we're going to get for the first year.
And I think one thing that you need to bring up when you go down there is the grant that we tried to get for the FCBA.
Mm-hmm.
Was that through Fire Safety? Fire Service?
Virginia Department of Fire Programs, I'm certain it was.
We didn't qualify for that, so we ended up paying, we thought we were going to get at least something, and we ended up paying $1.4 million out of our pocket. So guys, we ponied up for that, didn't get one dime to help us replace all of our SCBA, every piece of it. So hopefully y'all can help us there. I would definitely bring that up. Yeah. We got $0 to help us with that.
And we can't make the decision until you come back and tell us.
Correct. Like I just want the board just to think about it and let you know I'm going there. It's kind of like the last hurrah.
I don't think you're wasting your
time. I'd hate to give that $400,000.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, not only that, too, if we do have to return the $450,000, the $30,000 that we got for engineering costs, we're going to have to reimburse that back, too. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just wanted to bring that up to the board.
Does part of that 950 include the road back to it? I imagine yes.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, it includes a gravel. It includes a gravel roadway back to it, I believe.
I was gonna say because, if we get the other roads built,
and maybe in the meantime we can get maybe like the chamber to reach out to the business community and sponsor the burn, you know, provide some sponsorship.
So anyway, I just wanted to bring that up to the board, just so you're, you know, like I said, I'm going there. It's going to be, hopefully be kind of a, hopefully we can get some good outcome and in an increase, but we'll see.
All right. Thanks, sir.
Yep.
Next, new business, Blue Ridge carryover.
Yeah, Blue Ridge, really quick here. So for fiscal year 21, which ended June 30th, 2021, Blue Ridge had about a surplus from the funds that the county provided of about a little over $100,000 in the funds that we provided to Blue Ridge Health District for what they've been doing. And what did they say? We're finalizing our FY21 financials and have money left over due to general fund restrictions and COVID grants. Fluvanna stands to have a surplus of about $100,000. They're requesting to have these funds carried over to fiscal year 22, and they said anything would be used to support vaccination testing efforts. And there is going to be a slight increase. The General Assembly kind of change in the state how some of the funding is going to be. So we're going to see a slight increase in what we have to provide them, but they still haven't 100% figured out what that portion is to us. I've had some back and forth with them a little while ago. I also sent an email back to them that, okay, well, if these are general fund dollars coming back, and if they're doing it for vaccinations and testing, my thought is, okay, well, maybe why don't we take the general fund dollars that we gave them and put it back into our general fund? Maybe there's a way to use ARPA funds to apply it towards testing and vaccinations. That would certainly make more sense.
I think you can do that.
I think we can too. So,
talking about for the
so to me, I would rather see the $100,000 come back and go into our general fund and use, if we can do that, use ARPA funds if sure. They're wanting to increase some of their vaccination and testing efforts. Now, I responded back to them, and I haven't received a response back yet. Is there anything that they know of from them being the state entity for any restrictions why they couldn't accept ARPA funds from us?
Okay,
so that's, I haven't heard back from them, but I just wanted to let you know. I'll come back something more formally with the board once I hear something, but that would be my recommendation if we could do it that way. So that's it for Blue Ridge. Like I said, no action item. And then
John Proxy.
John Proxy. So again, John needs to appoint a proxy to vote for certain things for the board. One of the proxies would be to elect officers on the JAUNT board. Also, potentially, as you know, there is an interim director for JAUNT right now, and they are currently, I don't know the ins and outs, but you know, they may have to hire for an executive director again. Again, that proxy could take part in hiring that executive director for JAUNT. So they're requesting a proxy, and as they said, your proxy may be the county administrator or maybe one of your appointed board members. The two board members on the JAUNT board right now is Miss Pamela Bevins. She's been on there, I think, for maybe a month or two. And you know, they talked that out of the FY21 meetings, she's attended two of two meetings, and then Hal Morgan, who's been on there for quite some time, and he's attended 10 of 10 meetings. Mm-hmm. So again, or I guess the board could appoint one of the board members too. So just wanted some guidance from the board on how they want to appoint a proxy.
Remember that they don't want, these two people can stay. Right.
They would be for a special voting member to vote on officers for the JAUNT board, and then potentially take part in any recruitment or appointment of an executive director. So that could be one of these two individuals. As I said, it could be myself. So the board could say, well, I want you know Mr. Weaver to be on be the voting member or something like that. So.
I think Mr. Marshall, who's been on there for 10 years.
Mr. Morgan?
Morgan. He should be.
I've got no problem with that. I was just going to ask if one of y'all that I wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm. You know, my thinking on that is, you know, that because of what happened at JAUNT, you know, that having kind of an outsider look at it, it doesn't hurt. I'm happy to do it. I mean, I'm in Charlottesville, so I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, Mr. Like I said,
I mean, you're an outsider from my perspective, so.
Yeah, I mean, I am, you are, you know, Mr. Morgan, he was.
And that's not dismissing any of their efforts. No. They're part of the board.
Yeah, no, they are.
So, and I would certainly advise.
My thoughts were to open it up to anyone here that would want to do it first.
Yeah, and like I said, that's why I'm bringing it up to the board, because it's the board's decision.
He's up there in Charlotte.
I'd be happy to participate in that. I think that goes back to the whole oversight thing in terms of oversight.
Yeah, I just wonder if Mr. the man that's been on there forever, I mean, how many years has he been? He's like 10 out of 10?
Well, for fiscal year 21, he's attended 10 out of 10 meetings for fiscal year 21. So I don't know how long he's been on the board. I don't think it's been entirely long.
Does every district that's on that board have two people?
I do not.
I'm wondering if other counties are appointing people already on the board.
I am certain they are probably reaching out to other localities that have joint representation and requesting the same thing.
Well, and
I think they need you.
Yeah, and I would say, Mrs. Booker, it's not as if I'm not going to reach out to them for their opinions.
Yeah, that's what I wanted. Right. That's the thing.
Saying,
I don't want to.
Just taking an outside objective perspective.
I mean, I'm on the board, and then you're going to
And not dismissing them being on the board, but the higher ranking people around here are the five of us. I mean, then six is be him.
No, that's the only thing that I want to make sure that we're not, I don't want to use the word insulting, but not.
No insult intended. I think that's why they're asking for a proxy, because they understand the seriousness of, you know, the damage that was done to the organization.
Yeah, and they really don't serve us very well. You know, when I tried to have them help a man in my close to me, and he's old and he's afraid to lose his license because of his age. And in order to go to the doctor, pick him up at 7 in the morning, and he wouldn't be brought back until after 3. And he's 85. How can he sit at the hospital all day? That's just
the very least they should take him to the senior center.
We need to give him more money. Then they can.
I don't think that's
possible. That's not it. I don't think they want that 85-year-old man to sit in the hospital until 3.
But that's what they told me. Make sure they get to the point about around 10.
And just for your knowledge, so really the reason for this is for the annual shareholders meeting, which is Wednesday, October 13th at 9:45 a.m. in the junk conference room. So that's the original intent of it. And again, it could be for possible appointment of an executive director or an officer, but that electing officers is the original intent. So
here, Mr. Morgan has only been on there since February of 2020.
That's what I thought. I thought he's been on there a little over a year, year and a half. So
still longer than
this. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But I think if one of our board members wants to be on there,
right.
I think that they should be there first.
I'm just wanting to make sure that's
not meant to offend anyone.
Yeah, as it says, proxies will elect executive officers to the joint board of directors, may be called upon to appoint the executive director position, and cast votes on any other matters that may come before them at shareholders meetings. So that's kind of the intent. So if, to me, this is probably more of an action item, and I can put it on the next consent agenda if the board says, I mean, I can let Ms. Davis know that if the board is in consensus that it's going to be Mr. O'Brien, I can let her know.
Okay with that?
Sure.
Okay. So,
Karen Davis is the interim.
She's the interim CEO. Okay.
All right.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, Danny. Oh, public comment.
Yeah, public. So just a quick thing on public comment. So right now for public comment, we've got lots of means for the public to comment. We have certainly people can attend in person. We have something new that we've implemented since COVID, which is people can come online and they can speak. And you know, there's been a little discussion back and forth about individuals, you know, do they submit letters? Should county or board members read the letters that everyone submits?
I know the schools were doing it at one point. I think they eliminated reading letters from public comment. And so this is just kind of really a big discussion piece. You know, we're getting lots, we're getting a lot more people submitting letters and they're asking them to be read. And again, we can do that. And I'm not saying we don't want to read the public's comments, but I just wanted some
It's a lot easier to sit there and write a letter and send it in and say, read this.
Yeah, that's not quite right, I don't think.
I don't know if there's a perfect way to say it, to do it. You could get inundated by letters.
And if you do one, then you have to do them all. That's another thing.
And I know that was one of the bones of contention with the school.
So why don't we draw
some were being like read,
some ordinance or something, and have it in our bylaws so that everybody would know that. Treat everybody the same.
That's the biggest thing. Be consistent.
Well, and I think, you know, certainly with Zoom meetings and so on, there's, you know, it's easier for people to make that public comment as it stands right now. But
yeah,
how long will we continue to do Zoom meetings? I mean,
well, honestly, we think we're in for the long haul now.
Which I think is great. I think that's a good thing. So.
Which letters do you want to read when they want
to read? No, I'm saying that they have the opportunity to read their own letters as well.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah, I mean, that
instead of
They don't have to come here in person.
Time or whatever, but they don't have to be here in person. They can,
What about the people who aren't savvy using, some of the older people don't have computers?
You can call in.
Oh, that's okay.
So there's still call-in information. You can call in from a landline.
Okay.
So there is.
Can you make some ordinance of some sort?
I don't even think we need an ordinance.
It's just in our
We can look from our maybe our bylaws or something if there's anything in there. But again, this is just more from a discussion point of how are we doing this and making sure we're equitable across the board. Because for instance, I got one letter that in which is fine, to read and we're getting a lot more letters. People are like, read this. I can't be there. Well, look, we've got in person. Which I understand a lot of people can't make it in person, but with the Zoom component of it, I think we've opened up the avenues for people to make public comments on their own.
Or telephone, I think that one was a good one.
Right.
How do people do that?
Just call it.
And there's a little code you have to punch in to get access to the meeting.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't see that code. It is a code.
Yeah. So, I mean,
the link can be automated, too. So.
And again, I don't want to discourage people from saying they can't send in letters. They can send in letters, and, when I get an email, I'll forward it to the board, or if someone wants the board to see something, I'll certainly get a letter and give it to the board. But, I mean, at what point are we just going to be reading everyone's letters and no one's going to be really commenting on their own?
Well, actually, you won't have all the letters by the time we get the report in our packets.
No, but generally, sometimes we're getting letters the day before.
Tonight.
Yeah, I mean, like tonight, we put some letters on your desk in front of you for some individuals that have.
I think they want to know that they're being read.
Yes.
And as you said, if we get a package of the letters, that's there for us to read. If they want to speak personally, they can speak personally.
Yeah.
I understand that can be intimidating, but as you said, when you're, on the phone, it's a little bit easier.
Yeah.
It can be intimidating to stand in front.
Yeah.
But on the phone, it's not necessarily.
So kind of what I'm hearing is we're going to move forward with something where we're not necessarily going to read letters moving forward, but we have opportunities. We'll certainly get the letters to the board for them to read, whether it's emails, we'll forward those emails on, we'll print out hard copies for the board to review.
Yeah, before a meeting, we might not have time to read all of them.
No, you're correct.
But I think it's important for all of us to read these.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and again, and that's one of the timing issues. If we don't get the letter prior to the package going out, the only time we have to give you the letter, the soonest time is to put it in front of you at the next meeting, or if not, we have to wait another 2 weeks for the.
And then is the letter going to be considered to be read as part of the public comments for a public hearing? The comments for a public hearing, as an example, you could have 600 letters, right?
Yes.
you know, that's not
necessary. Can you imagine if we'd have had letters written when we did the Second Amendment thing?
Yeah.
Yes.
We'd have had letters from across the country.
Yeah, right.
So anyway, that's kind of what the discussion I wanted. I think I hear where we're going with that, and we'll try and come up with something a little more formal. But that's, I think we just need to put something out, you know, on our webpage, on the board's page about how we're handling, you know, public comments, letters, and stuff like that. So the community is informed.
All right. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir. I will now open the second round of public comment. Anyone wishing to address the board, please state your name, address, keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic, and direct it to the board.
Yes.
Ms. Rayner?
Yes.
Go ahead, ma'am.
Okay. Do you want me to state my name and address?
Please, ma'am. That's for the record.
Patty Rayner, Broken Island. So I just want to go back to the Zions Crossroads survey. I didn't see any surveys because I would have certainly liked to have completed one of those. I feel like I just kind of learned a little bit about the roundabout that is being, I guess, proposed for the 250 and Route 15 intersection. And I don't know, I'm pretty sure some of you, probably you, Mike, will remember, there was a roundabout there, 70s. And
yes, ma'am.
That roundabout was removed because of the number of fatalities. And I know that roundabouts are trendy and cool, but they are very costly for safety reasons and also for financial reasons. You know, we spend a lot of money for these roundabouts versus lights. The lights work really well.
Ms. Rainier,
I don't think
I'll just tell you that one's in Louisa, ma'am. That one's not us.
Okay, so when they were talking about the 250 intersection, is that not part of us?
No, we're about 100 feet south of that, ma'am. That's where our line is.
Okay, well, that's good to know.
Yes, ma'am.
Is Louisa, well, you guys might not even, maybe you probably do not, if they're putting one in. But in any event, I guess there are two other roundabouts that are going in the Fluvanna County area. I'm not sure where they are, but I know that they cost a lot more than lights. And so, you know, and there's a safety component to that. And that kind of brings me back to Broken Island. There's that sharp turn in Broken Island that when you go around, you have to kind of Y off to get into Broken Island. Well, the amount of traffic there has increased quite a bit, and there's quite a few times that I can have to sit there for 5, 6, 7 minutes just trying to get out of Broken Island. Now, I'm not saying we need a roundabout there, but I know that VDOT took out the guardrail because they said too many people have hit that guardrail. And when I questioned Alan Saunders about that, I was like, well, isn't that why it's there? Because you have houses, Lake Monticello has houses right in that curve. And if those cars don't hit that guardrail, they're going into the backyards or possibly into those people's houses. So he said it costs too much, but then when I asked him about the cost, he said that whoever hits the guardrail, their insurance company has to pay for the replacement of that guardrail. So there's a contradiction of who is paying it and what he is actually talking about costing too much. Because then they put up these arrows, and of course there's an accident there at least about every other week, it seems like. And, you know, if I lived in one of those houses, I'd be terrified that somebody's going to run through my house. I mean, one of the houses has a fence up there. Cars have run through that fence to that property. So I know that from last night's meeting, there was a lot of discussion about the village garden and safety issues there with the traffic. And, you know, this is just another one of those things where, you know, VDOT, you know, they have a lot of specifications for, you know, what they consider safety issues on roads and guardrails and all these things. But it seemed like nobody has really gotten that information. And it seems like they apply that for some areas, but not others. So I mean, I don't understand what the contradiction is. Either there is a safety issue, there isn't. But, you know, when they start kind of back and forth about, well, then there's a cost component, and it's costing too much, but then they tell you that cost is picked up by the insurance company of whoever hits that guardrail, then it's not a cost component. And we, you know, we're dealing with the traffic at Food Line. I mean, you can barely get out when you come out of Turkey Sack there, out of the Food Line. So I have tremendous concerns about those. So like I said, I don't know where these other two roundabouts are, but instead of spending $100 million, I guess, on roundabouts, I think we could spend a lot less in stoplights that would work wonderfully.
Thank you, ma'am. Ms. Moore.
I'm so glad that I decided to come tonight. I have several meetings all this week, and when I don't have doctor's appointments, I seem to have meetings. I'm Susie Morris. I live at 6840 Thomas Jefferson Parkway, Quaint Lee Farm. I'm so glad I came tonight because I and several other people have called and tried to find out about this comp plan over and over. I have specifically asked where it was, what status. I could not until very recently get any answers on that. I asked who is working on this, because I know that there was public input before. I know we used to even have meetings where you come together, the people, and talk about it, look at it. I was told finally, oh, the Planning Commission and the Board of Supervisors does it. And I said, what about public input? What about citizens? It talks about citizen input, so it should be taken a little seriously. And, oh, well, I don't know. I said, well, what citizens are on it? And I was told a name from the lake and a name from the sheriff's office. They were both in law enforcement. I said, well, what other actual citizens are on this? Oh, well, they haven't been picked yet. I said, well, who selects them? I never got an answer, really. And it's not the first time I've asked about the comp plan. It's not the first time other people have asked about it. How would people even know tonight? This is part of the problem. How would people know tonight that it was going to be discussed as such? I got more information sitting here tonight than I or anyone else who has called, not once, but a number of times on this. Finally, I got, oh, well, the housing section is mostly done. We've been working with the Thomas Jefferson Housing District on it. That's going to be a major part of the plan. I said, but the current ones have always had 12 different sections, not one. The fact that now, if we know that it's going to be a shortened version, 45 or 50 pages, did this just happen, that all this information came about in the last few days or week? When the public asks for things and the public can't get the information, how do you expect people to participate? It would have been nice if all these studies that are talked about and the Zion's Crossroads plan and all these other things are supposed to be part of the comp plan, then it should have been made clear to the public at the beginning. We're cutting this shorter, and when you do those things, say, this is going to be a part of the comp plan. How is the public supposed to know? Not everybody is as persistent as I and as caring for Fluvanna County and what happens to it and how we do things. So who else is going to ask several times, what about the comp plan? What state is it in? Not many. There are a few others that have been calling, but not everybody's going to do that. And then tonight I hear commercial and industrial is the main focus now. The goal is to finish the Zions Crossroads. Get that in there. We're 6 months behind. There's a lot of regional housing in it. How are we supposed to know that if people call, like I call, and I ask, not once, but several times? Why, if all this was a planned thing, and it should be planned, just like what we have a vision for the county for and what we're doing should be planned, why was I not able to get answers at that point for the last 2 months plus? I don't understand it. County survey, that should have been noted somewhere on there. This will be used as part of the comp plan. Did we know that then when we were planning this? I've asked people on the planning commission during that time. Well, and also public comments tonight discussing that, that's important. And I'm glad I came, because then I could spread the word of what supposedly the comp plan is and how they're working on it.
Can we advertise it in the paper, or do we?
Well, that's what I was wanting to comment on.
And I was going to make some suggestions on what you could do, yeah, but I didn't.
Be on the website.
I'll be glad to talk to somebody.
Advertise in the paper, do those.
Thank you.
Mr. Weaver, you had asked about traffic circles. The IIHS and Federal Highway Administration's statistics have shown that roundabouts typically achieve a 37% reduction in overall collisions,
yeah,
a 75% reduction in injury collisions, and a 90% reduction in fatality collisions.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. So, and I think the
I wasn't against
I didn't look up the numbers, but the overall cost of maintaining a stoplight is somewhere in the I think it was like it was some astronomical number, like $40,000-$50,000 a year. I was a crazy number. I couldn't even believe it.
I think we're lucky to have as many roundabouts.
I know that
we
one
have.
Of the roundabouts is going in up where the young man was hit and killed up on 250, Troy Road, 250.
Mm-hmm.
Right there at the small industrial park right across the road. I know that that's one of them. I'm not sure where the other traffic circle is designed.
My next door neighbor was killed at the intersection of 53 and Lake Monticello Road, where the roundabout is now. So he was riding his bike, took a left turn, struck and killed.
The roundabouts that they were talking about at Zions Crossroads are mostly in Louisa. Mm-hmm. There is only the one by Troy Road in Fluvanna. And when they showed us what it looked like, I mean, there were traffic circles across from each other as you're coming out of
McDonald's. I bet you is going to be
Lowe's.
At the far end down there where the other parts
yeah,
are.
Yeah, I mean, nothing's finalized. That's why
they're just discussing.
Louisa's got a lot more long-term traffic issues right up in that area, and there's not really a fantastic solution for the different traffic flows, so they're having to analyze that a little bit more.
We're likely to have what we have,
well,
I think.
To me, this would be one of those things where they're actually looking at what's going on here, with what's going on in 53 and 15. Yeah. When it first got put into 53 and 15, I was like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. But now, you used to have traffic backed up all the way past the dog park in the morning, trying to get to school. Driving a school bus, it was miserable, and people were cutting through EW's parking lot. Now, you have no backup, none.
And that's a fair point. That's a hidden cost to intersections is the amount of delay that citizens have,
mm-hmm,
you know, waiting for
making
a turn. Yeah, that's a hidden cost.
I was trying to think about the one she was talking about, the old one at Science Cross. But that wasn't really a roundabout, I don't think.
I don't think there was a roundabout there. I think it was just two stop signs for 15
right,
and
right.
250 had the right of way. I think it was kind of like Firecliff.
I've heard there was a roundabout out there.
Roundabout.
You don't remember it?
I don't remember.
I'm struggling to remember it. I remember the Gordonsville one, but not one inside. It may have been
they
one.
They didn't even have roundabouts.
Ms. Morris, do you remember a roundabout at Zions Crossroads? Mr. Morris?
In Zions Crossroads?
At Zions Crossroads?
250.
I remember the somebody having a wreck in court when I was there, and the judge asked him, how did you have a wreck? He said, you must have been going too fast. He said, I was going 15 miles an hour, turned over.
Turned over. Oh, man. All right. Well, is there any other public, anyone else for public comment? I'm sorry.
So just one final one, since we've got one to read, and this is from the chaplain, Chaplain Francis.
We don't want to make a chaplain, man.
We read that one.
Yeah, and like I said, maybe we can make, since it's one of our...
Nothing's changed so far.
Yeah, we can make this the last one.
There you go.
So I'll try and be quick. So to members of the board and all in attendance, I've been a resident of Luana County for 25 years. I possess many years of serving others, 31 as a registered nurse, 13 in EMS, and almost 11 as active chaplain with the Luana Sheriff's Office. I am proud and pleased to see that the unhealthy view towards law enforcement found in some localities has not found its way in the relationship between people of Luana and our Sheriff's Office. This should be commended. Hidden behind the present major headlines are several stories of cities struggling with getting their law enforcement personnel back to par. This is a result of their previous decisions to defund or restructure their public safety agencies. Many are desperately trying to find trained personnel as crimes towards their own citizens increases. Again, I am pleased and proud that Luvanna had not given in to those radical decisions. But we still have a struggle. Just like the hiring dilemma in our local healthcare institutions, the FSO is challenged with offering competitive compensation. The surrounding counties are also short of personnel. In response, their local leaders are finding ways to generate more funds and perks to get their forces up to maintain the safety of their citizens. No one wants to live in a town labeled unsafe on social media. My hope is that the BOS would once again be proactive and work alongside the Sheriff's Office to help with this issue. These officers have families to support like we all do. The bonus for us is that they live here and are personally invested here. So it is logical to make all their efforts to keep them. The salary compensation proposal will surely help to retain the excellent team we presently have. In almost 11 years as chaplain and 6 as reserve deputy, I can truthfully say that we have the best group of that time period. The commanders of the operation division work very hard and well together. They take care of their people. They have high expectations, thus have vastly increased training requirements to help the team meet those expectations. Morale has been higher even years before the issues facing law enforcement arose. Sheriff's Hess mantra has always been, treat others the same way that you'd want to be treated. This pertains not only to the citizens we serve, but towards each other. I personally watched the sheriff spend many hours over the years being available to people and talking with them. He listens with his head and his heart. He cares for others over himself. This is a valuable trait that God commands us to have, especially as a leader. This is because God knows it is the answer for a healthy community. Our school resource officers have developed quality relationships and trust with students. The court staff has adapted to the daily variables that they face over the past year and a half, still executing their purposes. Dispatchers have worked diligently behind the scenes, shorthanded for some time, yet they keep up with the volume of calls from people in need. They also manage the many vital tasks to keep the communication process smooth and safe. This is no ordinary job. We also have a strong, energetic, well-trained, and dedicated volunteer reserve corps. 3 of their biggest compliments about the agency are leadership, inclusive training, and camaraderie. They have developed a love of serving the community alongside the welcoming time staff. The people of this agency are my family. I deeply love them and honor to have this God-given assignment to serve them. We need to know and remember that dedicated law enforcement consists of special people. They are specifically called by God to stand in the gap between harm and the innocent. This group are willing to take on anything to protect others, just as our country's brave military, which some have served in and are still serving. They are there during holidays, day and night, fair weather and dangerous weather, natural and man-made disasters. We need to be sure they are always here. Over the past 3 to 4 years, the FSO has developed quite a reputation among other law enforcement agencies. The words I hear from them are strong leadership, consistency, teamwork, support, and service. It is my plea for you to consider these truths I've stated and help this proposal move forward. At this very moment, you have the opportunity to put Fluvanna on the map as one of the safest communities in Central Virginia. We have more subdivisions coming. Help our current and future residents to be confident in their decisions to live here, not just the confidence of a good financial decision, but of and the one. Their choice to raise their families in a safe and united community. Lastly, please know God is pleased with those who are united. Unity, what he is about. Thank you for your time and attention. With sincerity and truth, God bless you all. Chaplain Frank Signoretti.
Real quickly, because I think we probably should have mentioned this maybe as part of the initial report. Your report, right, is the 9/11 memorial that was held.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it was noteworthy.
Yes.
Because it was the 20th anniversary. The speakers all had a common thread, and it was interesting that it was about unity. Signorelli, Pastor Signorelli, Chaplain Signorelli spoke and gave the prayer as well, too. During that meeting, there were actually three calls in that same meeting, and it was remarkable to watch all the first responders, and I mention this because, you know, the sheriffs are first responders as well, you know, leave, first sort of crew leaves, second crew leaves, to watch the fire trucks and the rescue vehicles leave. And so when we hear, you know, the demand and the need for these rescue vehicles, it's easy to say, well, we have one of those. But it was very interesting to be there when we're talking about 9/11 and we're talking about the sacrifice that first responders made, and then to see three calls happen almost within minutes of each other and watch these vehicles disperse. Mm-hmm. I just want to commend the board for its hard work in trying to strengthen core services in the county. So that was really a remarkable thing to watch.
Yep, thanks for bringing that up. I completely forgot to get that on my COVID report. Yeah, and that was there, so.
Chief 50 does a great job with that. Yep. I'm just sorry.
No, that's fine. And I think maybe next year we again run an ad, just because, I mean, it's, you know, and on the one hand, I was looking at the same faces that I've seen there every year. It was a little bit bigger crowd, but you would have thought on the 20th anniversary you'd have 1,000 people show up or something.
It had a very small...
You wouldn't
small,
have enough room there.
Yeah.
If something like that happened, you'd
yeah,
have to do
it. Yeah, it had a very, like very small thing in the Fluvanna Review. You could almost miss it. In the past, they have sent out letters to every supervisor inviting them to it. I did see it in the paper, but I didn't see the letter.
I got an email. Mm-hmm.
We did.
I didn't.
I'm
sure I did, probably.
But Ms. Steele was there. She saw it all happen. Okay. It was very impressive.
See, you talk about unity. I mean, the different groups, when they have their awards ceremony, mm-hmm. one of the other companies will show up with an entire crew covered, at least the first call. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we've had that happen. And because they're not as familiar with roads, a couple of us will go with them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just, it is family.
Yeah.
That's why I said that. I like to give my brother a hard time, but he means the world to us along with all the rest of us.
Mr. Chair, I move the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors in there.
Oh, hang on. I think I've forgotten to close the second round of public comment, but I don't think we've ever had anybody else.
No. Well, yeah, unless there's someone else.
I don't think there's anyone else. So let's close the second round. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I move the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors entering to close meeting pursuant to provisions of Section 2.2.3711A8 of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended for purposes of discussing litigation.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mrs. Booker. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Mr. Chair,
one thing is it litigation or legal?
I'm sorry, legal.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, it's always confusing.
Can we
have they're different.
Now?
I can explain it. Yeah.
All right, the chair votes aye. We're now in closed session.
Mr. Chair, I move the closed meeting be adjourned and the Savannah County Board of Supervisors convene again in open session. Be resolved, the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify to the best of each member's knowledge. One, only public business matters lawfully exempted from the open meeting requirements in the section 2.2-3711A of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended. And two, only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened were heard, discussed, or considered.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Motion's made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Booker. Ms. Eager?
Aye.
Ms. Booker?
Aye.
Mr. O'Brien?
Aye.
Mr. Weaver?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. We are now out of closed session. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
Quick question. What is this? What is this? I don't understand what they're talking about.
Yes, I mean, so, I mean, did you get a chance to read it, Will?
I looked at it in my eyes.
So my general understanding of it is, and there's a lot of legal in there. It's written like it's written by a legal button. If you look at page 2, I think it is, the very top line, I think what it is requesting is, because it talks about vaccinations and masks, I think what this resolution or what Powhatan is requesting is that other localities approve a similar resolution, which basically is saying we're not interested in mandating masks or vaccinations. That's my non-legal.
I didn't catch that live, but I think that's exactly.
Yeah, that's it. I read.
That's what I read about 2/3 of it. And that's what I had.
I think the idea is that they want the General Assembly to limit the governor's power.
Yes.
To boss people around.
Yes.
Right.
So it passed Powhatan by 3-2.
Somebody who just had COVID breakthrough, I probably think you have some strong opinions about that.
All right. No, let's just, that's something just to think
more
about.
None whatsoever.
We're not going to discuss it tonight.
No. Yes.
Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So may. Yep.
Got a motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Mr. Booker. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. We're now adjourned.